Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
How are we doing so far? Good people of Portland! Want y'all to know something in case you didn't already? We are just getting started! I can't hear you! Lose your head! I don't know, Joe Dolphy, and now this song is about... I don't know if I should say this tonight, because I know we got law officers here, and I'm packing a gun tonight. I'm packing my pistol. You know what I'm talking about, don't you, Pittsburgh? Talking about my six shooter of sex. Talking about my Uzi of ooze. You know what it all comes down to? I'm talking about my lip gun!
So here's a little something just for you, Portland, Oregon.
He's talking about his penis, Don.
Oh. Oh.
His member.
Well, why didn't he just say that?
Well, it's sort of a phallic / verbal scavenger hunt.
Hey, Pittsburgh! I came here tonight complete with my penis! You know what I'm talking about!
Tonight, kiss and penis. I saw him do that same rap. I guess it would have been on the reunion tour, maybe. It was 96, so it must have been the reunion tour. But he did like a variation on that stage rap going into the song, you know, Love Gun, which is just the worst song. I don't get me wrong, I love
Lick
Kiss.
Lick my love pump.
I love Kiss, but Love Gun is a pretty terrible song. Not as bad as some others they've done, but it's not good, like in the strict sense of the word. But he did a much longer intro, and it was a point of retarded pride with me that I was actually able to spot it just with, like, the first two or three words. When he went, "You all have to go through security when you came in the night." Oh, hey. No, not me. I came in the back way. And it's a good thing. Because Salt Lake, I am packing. And I was immediately like, oh, my God, this is going to be Love Gun. Which I realize now in retrospect is a stupid thing for me to be proud of. It was dumb that I was even able to identify that. I wonder if when he was just walking around doing whatever it is Paul Stanley does, flouncing, and when he came up with the line, "My Uzi of ooze," if he actually rummaged around for like a spiral pad or something to write that down on. You know, he's just like, Yolanda, get me a pen. I just get six shooter of sex. Write that down. Uzi. No. Uzi of ooze. Yeah, write that down. Which sometimes he augments that by saying, I swear to Christ, I'm not making this up. Occasionally, he will augment his pre-Love Gun intro there by saying, and when I say gun, I'm talking about a long-barreled gun. 6 inches of steel, and then he will point to somebody in the front row, and he'll say, that girl could make into nine. There you go. Paul Stanley from Kiss, ladies and gentlemen.
So you enjoy these drums in this piece of music here? You enjoy this drumming that you're listening to right now?
Are you going to tell me that what's his name, Mike Portnoy or whatever his name is from Dream Theater is leaving?
He has announced he's leaving Dream Theater.
Yeah. Here's the thing is, this will sound strange. I'm actually not like a huge Dream Theater fan. I mean, you know, I'm not opposed to Dream Theater in any way. It's not like I'm not against them. But they're kind of proggy. So I have, I'll put it this way. I have, maybe I listen to Dream Theater more than like you do, the average person. But you know, but Dream Theater.
It wouldn't actually take much to listen to them more than me, since I have never listened to them. Ever
Dream
other
Theater
than
is
that piece of music.
They're one of those bands where they are just some of the most astounding musicians you will ever see in your life. And they're way better than a lot of progressive rock or progressive metal in that the thing that everybody would agree on probably is that the album that I won't get bogged down in this, but the album that song that we use at the beginning of the Rick Emerson Show, Pull Me Under, it comes out this album called Images and Words. And everybody I know had the same experience when that album came out. Oh, first of all, we all heard the song Pull Me Under on the radio. This was like maybe in 93 or something. And we all went like, oh my God, what is that song? And I was actually working at a rock station. And every time we'd play it, I mean, the phones would just light up. As Paul Stanley would say, the phones would light up like a damn Christmas tree. And anyway, so people would call them and say, what is this song? And we'd say, oh, it's this band, Dream Theater. And then everybody had the same reaction to the full album, which is that, oh, every other song is good. So, like, song number one, great. Song number two, crap. Song number three, awesome. Song number four, crap. Five, great. Six, crap. On and on throughout the rest of the album.
So like the Star Trek movies.
Yes, exactly. But it was the odd number ones that work. No, but in Star Trek, it's the even numbered ones, right? Because it's Khan and then the whales and then the...
I don't know.
Whatever. It doesn't matter. The point is, the Dream Theater's kind of whole career, the whole oeuvre has been sort of like that to me. Where they will do a whole bunch of stuff that I don't care about at all, couldn't possibly care less about. And then they'll do something of just like, you know, flawless, breathtaking genius. And then they go back to making crap again for a while. They did a really, really good suite that was like a cover of Zeppelin songs at one point I quite liked. Anyway, it doesn't really matter.
Mr. Portnoy said that he became tired, basically, of always touring and recording all the time, constantly. And brought this up with the band and... as he put it, they determined they do not share my feelings and have decided to continue without me rather than take a breather.
They have inquired about the possibility of me becoming bent over the next few days, if not hours.
Me perhaps fornicating somewhere elsewhere, say off.
It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. It is 18 minutes after the hour of 1. And this, the month of September in the year of our Lord, 2010. Thank you for coming by, making it part of your listening day. We are live from the lushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, the home of quality. We thank you for joining us. It is Friday. Coming up today, we have a big thing. First of all, we were talking about this last hour during Legion of News, and then I mentioned this on the Facebook and on the Twitter last night. Kenny Johnson, late of the Shield. He played Curtis Lem Lemansky on Shield seasons 1 through 5. And I'm going to tell you right now, as we get further... See, you got to stop that, because I haven't given I haven't played the spoiler siren yet. There is no real spoiler siren, and there is no... what starts with a C? I was going to do like a something klaxon. Like a...
I don't know.
A plot. I can't think of another alliterative
term.
No, it doesn't really.
Plot,
it doesn't matter. The point is, there's going to be some spoilers this hour and in today's show. Not just about Sons of Anarchy, a few of those, but also about The Shield. And normally I would say, like, look, the show's been off the air now for a year and a half. It's your own fault. But, I mean, you know, life is busy. People only have a certain amount of time. I'll give you a couple more years before I start just spoiling it willy-nilly. Higgledy-piggledy, rat-a-tat-tat. But I will say that we're going to have some spoilers about the Shield coming up here in just a few, because last night, Don Taylor actually finished the last and final episode of the Shield, all 7 seasons. So you finished that, so we'll talk about that here in just a few. But then later on this hour, Mr. Kenny Johnson, who was on the Shield, is Curtis Lemansky. He is now on Sons of Anarchy as, I believe the character's name is Kozik, but it's K-O-Z-I-K. So I think it's either Kozik, but I think it might be Kozik, was your guess. I think that's correct. We'll talk to him later on in this hour. Coming up at 2 o'clock, Mr. Michael Schaub from Bookslut.com, which is a very fine and critically acclaimed book review and literature site, which has a lot of its headquarters in Portland, Oregon. He'll be in the studio with us. And still later this afternoon, Greg Nibbler and Sarah X. Dillon will join us for a bit of a crossover segment as today Fun Employment Radio tapes its 200th episode. So Fun Employment Radio, which can be found at funemploymentradio.com, tapes its 200th episode today. So we'll talk to Greg and Sarah about that. Plus Taser Watch, Hick Watch, and Stupid Criminal of the Week. Plus Don Taylor is tracking the following stories for you on this Friday.
A woman kills 2 co-workers at a cookie factory. The naked OSU player pleads not guilty to trespassing. And Oregon's suicide rate is higher than the national average.
All right, then.
So we win again.
Hurrah. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Don't forget, you can also email us if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be reached at Dawn, D-A-W-N, @rickemerson.com. Or the chat box is open if you like to do that. And somebody asked yesterday how it is that they contact us via Skype. Skype, in addition to providing our phone service, they can also be texted directly. That is Rick Emerson Show. If you're a Skype user, you can just text us at Rick Emerson Show. And I think, actually, if you're a Skype user, you can do that creepy thing that Bruce does, where you just call from your computer or whatever, and it just sounds like ultra high quality. It's like you're just standing behind me in the studio. So you can do that at Rick Emerson Show. That is how you do that. It's 503-505-6964. I had a great idea last hour during Legion of News where I was saying that we ought to sell bumper stickers that say, "I heart my Muslim president." Or maybe even just T-shirts. Because that's the thing. You put that on Cafe Press today, I mean, you sell a barrel full of those by the end of the weekend. Here's another thing they ought to sell, because I would buy one. I wrote this down last night. I made a note to myself because I'm halfway through a Futurama episode that I didn't get a chance to finish. It's the one where the mutants, the mutant uprising. I think it's actually called The Mutants Are Revolting.
Oh, yeah. I actually saw that. I saw one you didn't see.
Ha-ha. I somehow missed that one when it first aired, so I'm halfway through it now. So I'm going to finish that tonight. But it occurred to me, you know what they ought to sell? And I don't know why this doesn't exist. I mean, maybe they think there isn't a big enough audience, but I mean, Comedy Central, I think, has disproven that by bringing Futurama back. This is what I do with my free time. I write down things that should exist just so I can buy them. They ought to make little replicas of the heads in the jars.
Yeah.
Like a Nixon head. I would totally buy that. If they sold like a Futurama Nixon head, I would, maybe one that spoke. Were you like
push
you
a little button.
Press the button and go, "Nixon doesn't care for this saline," you know, or whatever. It's just, "I'm back."
Yeah, yeah.
Wouldn't you buy that?
I would.
From Futurama, whose head would you want in a jar?
Wow. Beck.
Really?
Yes.
Is Beck the way? Is that the episode where he eats the fish food? No, that's that's Nimoy. All right. Yeah. Well, in any event, there you go. This is all true. That's what I watched last night, Don. I watched Futurama, a happy show. A happy show filled with fun, frolicking adventures in which everything ends pleasingly. Let me just read to you now the email that I received from Don last night. Because the deal is, I knew we were going to be talking to somebody from Sons of Anarchy probably in the immediate future. And then yesterday, we found out, in fact, yes, Kenny Johnson, who plays Kozik on Sons of Anarchy, was going to be joining us today. You'll hear that later on this hour. And then I said, you know, that's Curtis Lem Lemansky. Isn't that awesome? And Don said, that is awesome. This means I have to finish The Shield. Because you had how many episodes left yesterday?
Two episodes.
In the entire season.
Yes.
Or entire series, rather.
Yes, the season finale, which was like an hour and a half long, and then the episode prior to that.
And so you went home and you watched that all last night. And mm-hmm. I hadn't warned you as such because I didn't want to give anything away. And this, I guess it's safe to say we are now entering a sort of spoilery part of this discussion. So if you...
Well, I want to say something first, though, before we get into this discussion, because there's a lot to discuss here. I say I did watch the final episode of The Shield, and then played some sort of online game to clear my head. My husband came home. I talked to him. Went to bed. Woke up at 3:30 in the morning from this dream that I have to tell you about the dream. And it was one of those things, too, where I went over the dream like three or four times in my head so that I knew I would remember it, so that I would tell you. Because sometimes I have weird dreams. This probably happens to you. And you go, man, that's insane. I'm going to have to tell someone about that tomorrow. And the next day you're like, crap.
So you don't like keep a thing by your bed or something so you can write down your dreams?
I used to, but then I would like blearily write down something that I knew for sure would bring it all back with clarity.
A note.
And then
a keyword.
And then I look at it the next morning and it just says eggplant. Or something. I'm like, I don't know what that means. So yeah, so I ran through. But here's the thing is, I've had a couple of stress dreams about work. And you told me that Sarah used to have these dreams where she would like, the show was just about to start and she was locked out of the studio and pounding on the door. And
she couldn't get in.
Couldn't get in.
Yeah.
Okay, I had this dream last night. Woke up at 3:30 a.m. It was 5 minutes to showtime. We were sitting here prepping for the show. And then you tell me that what you want to do is you want us to recreate basically everything we had said on the previous show the day before, just from memory.
Right.
And you wanted us to act it out using puppets that were characters from The Shield. And you dumped this bag of puppets on the table. And there was like, you know, a Claudette puppet and a Dutch puppet and a Shane puppet, and that we were going to use these and we were going to recreate all of the discussions we had had the day before. And I'm sitting here and I'm going, I don't know how to do that. I don't remember what we talked about yesterday. I don't even know how that would work. I don't know how we do that. And you were just like, no, it'll be great. Don't worry about it. Just choose your puppets. And that was when I woke up.
I guess this is where I'm supposed to say, what do you suppose that means? But it's either, there's only two possibilities here. One is, whatever that dream means is so unbelievably obvious that it's just it's silly to even ask. Or that it's so unbelievably complex and layered and nuanced that it can never be known.
Well, the best I've been able to figure out is that, first of all, yes, we knew that we were going to be talking to Kenny Johnson in the morning. And I watched 2.5 hours of The Shield before I went to bed. So that was in my brain. And then I remembered on the way into work this morning, we listened to Master of Puppets.
Yes.
Yesterday as part of the top five. So maybe the word puppets was in my head somewhere still. But one thing I did notice, though, it wasn't spoken about, but I knew it as part of the dream, this happening to me, is you dumped out the bag of puppets and there were all these puppets, but there was no Vic Mackey puppet because you had already pulled that one aside for yourself.
Well, that's exactly what I would do. It shows that you know me perhaps better than you think, Don.
But yeah, just that whole thing. No, it's going to be great. Just now choose your puppets.
Choose your puppets is sort of a great phrase, by the way. It sounds like something like Christopher Lambert would say, you know, in some like sort of knockoff Street Fighter, you know, Mortal Kombat type film. Choose your puppets. I have no idea. Were you panicked? Did you feel like you were not going to be able to complete? Leaving aside the insanity of the task.
Yeah, no. I was like, what? And I was sitting right here and I was looking at the clock and we were going to apparently start Legion of News because we were going on live in 5 minutes. And so it was like, we're just going to say all the same things we said yesterday. And I'm like, I don't know why, but you didn't say it.
All right, let me ask you this.
So you were just springing it on me at the last moment. I was going, I can't do that. I don't even know how.
So it's like 11:58. I'm dumping out all the S.H.I.E.L.D. puppets, characters in the S.H.I.E.L.D. on the table. And then I'm telling you that we have to recreate yesterday's show intact in its entirety using only the S.H.I.E.L.D. puppets, minus the Vic Mackey one, which I have taken for myself.
Right.
Have you posted on Facebook and asked what this means?
No.
Well, you got to do that.
This was the first I have gone public with this dream.
Okay. No. You got to do that because I'd be curious to know what the audience has to say about that. All right. Maybe not even during the show. Maybe when we go to the Kenny Johnson interview or something, you can post that because I'd like to know their interpretations of that.
Okay.
Let's see. So anyway, so that is a conflation of a whole bunch of things. Not least of which that we're going to be having our interview with Kenny Johnson, late of The Shield and now Sons of Anarchy in a few. I will now say we're going to enter an area where we're going to have some spoilers regarding, probably less so regarding Sons of Anarchy, because it's not really much to spoil. He's only been on there for like 5 minutes. But The Shield, which has only been off the air for like a year and a half, and I'll give people a chance to get caught up in that, because it does have, I'll tell you this, so we're now entering the Shield spoiler zone. Because The Shield does have, I thought I was the only person who felt this way, or maybe who had said this out loud. I was reading an article last night because your email, you sent me an email that we'll read in a second, but it got me thinking about the S.H.I.E.L.D. finale. And I was just, it was on like Wikipedia or whatever, just looking up, you know, whatever other people had to say about it. And it was Maureen something or other from the Boston Globe. And she actually called the S.H.I.E.L.D. She said that the S.H.I.E.L.D. was, in her opinion, which I share, by the way, that it was the best series finale she had ever seen. And I'm not saying it's the best series I've ever seen. And I'm not saying that it was a flawless show, because it had a few weak points, especially as it got toward the end, at least in my assessment. But the actual finale of The Shield, I do agree, and I've said this actually since the day I saw it, is the best series finale I've ever seen. And I grew up with all the classics: MASH, Saint Elsewhere, Newhart, Roseanne. I'm saying for me, though, The Shield finale is as good as it gets. But here's the email that Dawn sent me last night at like 11 o'clock. The subject line is just, "Oh, dear God. I am at the halfway mark of the season finale of The Shield. Spoilers. Oh, my God, there's going to be spoilers. So if you're still listening now and you're spoiled for The Shield, it's your own fault." She says, "I am at the halfway mark of the season finale of The Shield. Shane just shot himself and they found his wife and kid laid out on the bed. I am heartbroken and I still have 45 minutes left. So there you go. And that's when I just kind of smiled a warm smile to myself, and I went about my business. I didn't even respond to that because I didn't know if you left your computer or something on. I didn't want like a dinging in the background to distract you. I wanted you to be able to wallow in the existential horror that was that finale, you know, by yourself without any interruption.
Yeah, I was certain that I was fairly sure that from things that people had said to me before that Vic Mackey did not end up dead at the end of the Shield, but I did have this moment there. I mean, I couldn't have been the only one who thought at some point in the next to the last episode when Claudette just completely loses it,
right,
after she finds out Mackey has immunity and he can't be prosecuted for anything. And she just completely loses it and just freaks out. And that had I can't be the only one who thought she's going to kill him.
Right.
She has cancer, and she has been pushed beyond the limits of her endurance.
That's interesting. I never thought about that.
And she's going
to
shoot him.
I never thought about the cancer thing giving her a sort of secondary reason to just say, I'm taking out the trash.
Yeah.
Because her whole season, the whole series, her whole character arc, just like Aceveda, has been like Mackey as mortal enemy, because she views him as everything that's wrong with the police force and the very definition of a corrupt cop. It never occurred to me that that's a sort of red herring, but I guess it is.
Yeah.
Wow.
But, with Shane particularly, that last season, I found myself just alternating constantly between feeling horrible for him and just hating him so much.
Yeah.
And being so angry that he was just making everything so much worse. And then just watching, particularly those last couple of episodes, watching his downward spiral get more and more intense and watching him get into a situation, particularly after his pregnant wife like shoots a couple of guys,
yeah,
shoots this woman and this guy in the town, and they're still just running around and trying to get money and they're trying to run off, and his wife say, but there was that point where it, you know, I wish it had come as a little bit more of a surprise, but when they had that moment when they went back to their house and when Mara was saying, what's going to happen to Jackson? They're going to put him in foster care, aren't they? And there started to be that. It's like where I'm going, oh God. There's going to be a murder-suicide pact here. But it turned out it was not a murder-suicide pact at all.
It was a murder-suicide.
It was not a suicide pact.
It was a pact with himself.
Yeah.
You know, here's the interesting thing about that. You know, that Sean Ryan had not intended for that to be the way Shane went out. When he originally wrote the finale, I don't know what the finale was originally, but there was, in other words, I don't know what the alternative was, but Shane did not do that in the original. And then that story about the wrestler Chris Benoit happened, and Sean Ryan was like, I'll put that in there. So I don't know whether it was finished or whether he had just not completed it yet, but that did inform that decision. But it really is, at least in the universe of The Shield, it was the perfect ending for Shane. I mean, in terms of his character arc. I mean, it was really the only way that whole thing could end. Here's the moment from The Shield finale. The moment from The Shield finale that really just... There's two moments that really just like they were like just being punched in the face, and I got this whole email from Seamus, who he's, you know, the great thing about Seamus is that he's sort of like us, except that he does everything in print form. So I know I'm not the only one who has these long, long, unbelievably detailed and, like, obsessive thoughts about television programs, because they come in my inbox at, like, 3 in the morning, you know, and it's like reams of paper to print them out. The two moments in that Shield finale that just are just gut punches to me. One, I work backward, because the first one actually leads to a larger point. The moment when they're dragging poor Ronnie away. Ronnie, who has just gotten the fuzzy end of the lollipop the entire series. First of all, that actor is like barely, you know, he's barely a footnote at the beginning. And then they introduce him only to screw his character and to make his character just completely, you know, just gets shafted at the end when he's doing that whole, you said there was going to be a team, oh, crap, you know, and they're just like dragging him into the hallway and Vic is sort of just like averting his eyes and they're just, and it was that thing, on the look on Ronnie's face when he realized he was being arrested and he was like, doing that thing of, you know, like, Vic, tell him we had a deal, you know, and it like became, and then he suddenly realized, oh, damn, there is no deal for me. Oh, Vic screwed me, just like he screwed everybody.
Yeah.
That moment where they're hauling Ronnie away is actually almost as bad to me as the Shane and his family moment, because you just get to see the realization on him that, like, you know, at the end, this guy that he knew he shouldn't have trusted screwed him anyway, and it was his own fault in some ways. Just like Shane finally realized it was his own fault and said, I wish I had never met Vic.
Although it really, it is interesting in the whole context of the show. I love the way they actually, they widowed everything down, all of the events, the tightened vice around Mackie, where he ends up in that position where he has to make that choice.
Yeah.
Because the one thing about him, the one positive trait in his entire personality was his loyalty. And now he's put in that position,
right,
that he has the two biggest things in his life, his loyalty to his crew and his obsession with his children and his ex-wife. And he's put in this position where he has to make a decision. Is he going to try and help Corinne, or is he going to honor,
right,
you know, Ronnie? And he actually, they have that long thing where he's sitting there before he signs the paper, where, you know, Chiklis is just doing this entire internal thing, and the camera's just on him while he's thinking. And it's like, he goes with that thing, well, I have to help my wife.
Well, that's, you know, and it is as someone once said about Richard Nixon, that eventually, no matter who you are, it will always come down to you or him, and it's never going to be you.
But it's also the moment when Mackie's soul really does finally, like, just snuff out its last little spark. Because that was the only good thing about him.
Was his loyalty.
Well, and then he finally just burns that, too.
Well, that's like Carlin's whole thing about how he's I can never remember this now. He's unethical but moral. That he would bend the rules but always for a greater good until the end. But, and so I'll get that, which leads to my larger point, but I will lead into that by saying this. The other really just, like, jaw-punching moment from that finale, and I think it's in the finale, is where he's having that horrid phone call with Shane, and Mackie says something like, I'm going to go visit your kids while you're in prison and tell them all about you and their mom, you know? And it's like the most cruel, horrible, vicious threat, that while Shane and Mara are in prison, Mackie is basically threatening to go visit his kids and just ruin their lives by telling them how terrible Shane and Mara are. And that leads to... And then we'll get into the news hour here, because we're going to get the interview with Kenny Johnson rolling. Big show, lots of stuff to get through today. I'm so glad you finished the show, by the way. I really am so glad you finished The Shield. Just because it was just, it's such a great show. Not a perfect show, but it is really an amazingly well-done program. The overarching genius of The Shield to me, I always have to stop because I always have to think, am I saying the Shield or The Wire? Because it's, you know, the whole thing. But the overarching genius of The Shield to me is, and this is exactly the reason Peter Carlin ended up not liking it at the end, is it does the most brilliant thing of beginning in one place 7 years ago, literally and figuratively and tonally, and then step by logical step ending in like this totally other place that you never would have predicted. And over the course of the series, very much makes you as a viewer question who you are and question your own moral compass, because at the end of the day, you realize that your hand that you thought was holding onto this heroic figure, you are just holding a handful of nothing. At the end, you realize that you have been brought around to rooting for a guy who is so deeply horrible in so many ways and who commits so many irredeemable, unforgivable acts, that it really is an amazing little bit of sleight of hand, where you said to yourself, like, I'm rooting basically for a guy who is an awful, terrible human being.
And not even just him. Like, Seamus popped up in the text box a minute or so ago and said that, isn't it amazing how when you're still feeling horrible for Shane after everything Shane had done.
You know, Shane, who in the series
dropped a grenade in Lem's lap.
And, by the way, helped Vic Mackey kill a cop in the first episode. So, yeah. I mean, but you're still, like, pulling for him. And that is the genius of The Shield, is that it is, like, that whole thing about the morally ambiguous main character has been so overdone, and it's done so badly. It's done just as badly and as often as the anti-hero. But The Shield raises the whole moral ambiguity thing to a level of execution that I don't think I've ever seen. Can I tell you this? The Shield and The Wire both, they so totally smoke The Sopranos in terms of a flat-out quality in acting, in my opinion, and in the making the morally ambiguous character, you know, the central focus of the show. I mean, I'm so glad you finished it. It's a fantastic
show. I did like how they had to have one bright spot, though, so they gave Corinne and the kids a happy ending. They take them,
Illinois.
They take them away, you know, and put them in the witness protection program. And I just loved the scene where they're standing on the sidewalk, and they look up, and there's just this perfect little white house, and there's this perfect neighborhood, and kids riding down the street on the bike with the helmets, and the FBI guy, the government guy, standing there apologizing. Well, there's parks and there's this
much.
And there's that. I'm sorry, it's not really. And she just says, "No, it's fine."
Yeah. It's, you know, the guy, the FBI agent that shows her the house, that is Clark Johnson, who directed the episode. He was Meldrick on Homicide. He's in season 5 of The Wire. If you watch the whole thing, you'll get to see him in season 5. Here's the real pisser, as they say, about the S.H.I.E.L.D. finale, is that of all the episodes and all the gin joints and all the world, Sean Ryan couldn't be on set for any of that because it was during the Writers Guild strike.
Oh, God.
And so he wouldn't cross the line, the picket line, and so he was not able to be on set. That entire season finale, on which everything hinged, he couldn't be there to see any of it filmed, and he had to just trust the actors and the director. So that'll just, that'll kill you. All right, so there you go. That's our... I'll put some tag at the beginning of the show, by the way. Somebody asked, how will they know when the spoilers are over? I'm going to put a little tag at the beginning that says, like, spoilers end at whatever, so they don't hear about Lemon the Grenade. And then he gives him a burrito beforehand.
Oh,
I have
God.
A burrito and a grenade. All right, let's all take a moment of silence for... I know a guy who got a Lem tattoo, by the way, and it says, like, Curtis Lemansky, like, 1972, 2005, or whatever his... Sigh.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
A former Oregon State University offensive lineman accused by police of being drunk and naked in a stranger's home pleaded not guilty yesterday. Tyler Thomas, 19, was arraigned on charges of criminal trespassing, criminal mischief, interfering with a police officer, and minor in possession of alcohol. Thomas was arrested last month after a pregnant woman told police she found a strange man in her home. Corvallis police said responding officers ordered Thomas to get on the ground. Thomas refused and instead dropped into a three-point stance like a football player and lunged at the officers. At that point, two officers fired their stun guns. Officers said Thomas was, quote, absolutely intoxicated at the time. Thomas was redshirted during the Beavers' 2009 season and dismissed from the team the day after the incident. Minutes after a woman was suspended from her job at a Kraft's food plant in Philadelphia and was escorted out, she returned with a handgun and opened fire, killing two people and critically injuring a third before being taken into custody. The shootings occurred shortly after 8:30 p.m. last night inside a northeast Philadelphia plant where workers for the nation's largest food manufacturer make cookies and crackers. About 10 minutes after the woman was escorted out, she returned in a car and drove through a security barrier before re-entering the building on foot. As she walked inside, she fired a shot at an employee who had followed her in and yelled, "Hide, she'd got a gun." That shot missed. The woman then shot the three victims. Police didn't immediately release the victims' identities or say whether they had been targeted specifically. Officers responded and isolated the shooter in a room, and she fired a shot at them but missed. Officers freed seven people who were in a bad position, they say, near the woman and were hiding. But the police would not refer to them specifically as hostages. The woman was apprehended about an hour after the shooting started.
I have to say, by the way, and so as we're beginning, getting ready for today's show, Dawn is just sitting over there. You're seething. You're just reading this story about the shooting at the Kraft thing. And you said, Rick, what is the one question you'd want to know about this plant after reading this story? And I said, I don't know. And you said, well, what did they make there? So that's the thing you seized on, was what was the nature of the Kraft manufacturing? And I think I told you that I didn't have an answer for it because in my head it was just a factory filled with cheese singles for some reason. But they made cookies, you're saying.
They made cookies and crackers. All and right. So it's like, you know, you just say cookies and crackers. I want to know what kinds of cookies and crackers.
Did you find any sort of a...
Well, yes, Kraft and Nabisco are part of the same conglomerate.
So it could have been...
so it could be Ritz crackers.
Nilla wafers, it could have been.
Could have been Oreos.
Yes.
Chips Ahoy.
All right.
Nutter Butters.
All right, so there you go.
Snackables.
Here's the thing about Nutter
Triscuits.
Butter. Nutter Butters are a great idea for a cookie, but the idea is not nearly... the idea is better than the cookie itself, because you get about two or three in, and it's like they've got this weird greasy film they leave in your mouth. Not unlike Oreos themselves, I guess.
Yeah, the first one or two Nutter Butters, you just go, wow, this is delicious.
No, it's great.
And then very soon, they just wear out their welcome.
Yeah, and you just think to yourself... I wish I'd quit eating these after, like, the first one. Here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
A new report said the suicide rate in Oregon is 35% higher than the national average.
We're number one! We're number one!
The report from Oregon Public Health said the state has 15.2 suicides per 100,000 people, compared to the national rate of 11.3. The report also said suicide rates have been increasing significantly since 2000, after decreasing in the 1990s. One risk factor is depression. State health officials said many people are able to manage their depression, but stress and crisis, like, I don't know, they don't say specifically, but I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe not having a job, can overwhelm one's ability to cope successfully.
Now, when they talk about stuff like this, do they factor in, like, assisted suicide, like medical suicide?
I don't know.
Because that would actually, it seems to me that would spike at the rate up high, because there's not a whole lot of, not like there's tons of states that have assisted suicide laws or anything. I mean, we're pretty much.
But we don't really, I don't, that might help, but I don't know how many assisted suicides do we actually have in a year? Because this was like.
Probably not a lot.
Because this
actually
was 15 suicides per 100,000 people.
All right,
You know, I don't know.
Part of that it might also have to do with the fact that there's maybe people are more, either people are more forthcoming about the fact that something was a suicide, or on the other hand, maybe cops are less likely to say it was something else. You know, there's that whole thing, because, you know, like sometimes the deal, you always hear that, like, I don't know if it's true, but you always hear, like, insurance policies won't pay if it's suicide. And so maybe before there was a little bit of a fudging where you just kind of go, I don't know, he was cleaning the gun and it went off or whatever. And now you just sort of say, well, you know.
I know that many, many years ago, before I ever moved to the Pacific Northwest, I had read somewhere that.
You heard about our skyrocketing self-inflicted death rate.
Well, I had heard that the suicide rate was really high in Seattle. And they said that that they blamed a lot of it on the weather.
Of course.
That because of the rain.
I think the weather is the weather's a straw man here. The weather is unfairly accused.
But I refuse to blame the weather because, you know, and I know I'm an anomaly, but I'm much happier when it's rainy and cool.
And also, it seems like if the weather really drove a disproportionate amount of the population to kill themselves, like, that would have worked itself out by now. You know, I think they would. The government would have just sort of, like, fenced off the entire Northwest and said, live somewhere else.
Yeah. I think it's the number of hippies that drives people to suicide, frankly.
I like to think so, and there's only one way to cure that. Isn't that right, Don?
Get rid of the hippies.
Yes. There will be a reckoning. Well, I reckon it's time to talk about Castalia Language Center. Oh, that Rick Emerson. Castalia Language Center is a small private school in downtown Portland. Okay, now here's the thing, and I mean, I'm not just doing a thing where I'm trying to, you know, tie the. Can I just tell you this?
Sure.
When I would watch The Shield sometimes, I would always be, I would kind of be covetous of, you know, a little bit jealous of the fact that that Vic Mackey spoke Spanish, and he spoke conversational Spanish, because he's out there in the street, and he's, you know, he's immersed in it and whatever, and not like everybody's going to be going and, like, working for the Rampart Division for the LAPD or something anytime soon, but that is an extreme example, I suppose, but there are large sections of this city, this state, this country, these United States, where if you can go somewhere, you can speak Spanish, you can speak conversational Spanish, it's certainly going to be helpful in a lot of places. It's going to make things...
Like East L.A.?
Yeah, it's going to make things easier in a lot of places. It's going to be crucial in certain areas, and of course, if you want to travel... Look, don't be like Rick Emerson. Don't be the ugly American, where I just go everywhere and I go, like, do you have a salad? You know, or whatever it is that I'm trying to find, you know, or I'm just like...
This is why your wife travels alone, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it is. Also...
You're not coming with me.
Also why her parents keep reminding her about other more prosperous men that she could have dated, perhaps members of the church. But she goes somewhere, and she just picks it up because she will travel and she'll go to a country, and she doesn't do the thing of, you know, of like, where do all the white people go in this country? You know, where she goes, you know, away from home, and you know, like, some people will travel, but when they travel, they try to find a place that is as much like their home as possible. Like, if they could just find a place that was a replica of their own living room, they would just stay there while they were in, like, Liberia or something. And she didn't do that. You know, she actually goes, and she just goes wherever it strikes her fancy, wherever it, you know, seems that things are actually happening. And that's where you learn the language best, because you're immersed. Well, that's what Castalia does. It is a language center that is predicated on the knowledge that adults don't necessarily learn the same way as kids. And so what they do is they teach adults to speak Spanish, and they teach you in classes of no more than 8 students, which means it's comfortable, it means it's relaxed, it means you're going to learn with other adults. You're all learning in the same way and at the same rate. Clara Grebel is the owner of the school. She's from Argentina, and she keeps her support right here on the Emerson News Network. So repay that support by contacting her via PortlandSpanish.com. That is the website, PortlandSpanish.com. Castalia Language Center, a small private school in downtown Portland that offers Spanish language classes for adults. Isn't that right, Don Taylor?
Yes, sir.
I thought you had a Portland. Okay, I was throwing you a little alley to your oop there because I thought you were going to have a Spanish phrase prepared.
Well, I was, but the thing is, while you were talking, I went to a place where it had slang Spanish language
phrases. And is it
phrases.
All profane?
Most of them. I just learned 3 different ways to say go F yourself. And I discovered that a derogatory term for a lesbian is la tortillera, which means a tortilla maker. And apparently that's a derogatory term for a lesbian.
That doesn't even make any sense.
La tortillera.
All right.
I don't know.
I'm glad to see that racism is equal. The prejudice is equally stupid in all languages.
Yeah.
All right, well, there you go. Don't say that. No. Kids, Don Taylor is not a role model.
I can now tell you that I have a hangover in Spanish, though. These are not things that you would learn from Castalia Language Center, however. They probably teach you useful things to say in Spanish.
I'm going to let you navigate our way out of this particular dead end.
Don't be like me. Don't just learn dirty words on the internet. Go to Castalia Language Center and learn actual Spanish that you can speak with respectable people.
All right. Look over there. Hey, it's the Rick Emerson radio program. My name is Rick Emerson. Coming up next hour, we will talk to Mr. Michael Schaub of Bookslut.com. Also, Sarah X. Dillon and Greg Nibbler of Fun Employment Radio. Fun Employment Radio celebrating its 200th episode later on today. They'll be taping that. So we will have those guys in the studio in just a bit. Don Taylor, what other headlines are coming up following our interview with Mr. Kenny Johnson?
Well, Portland police busted a check fraud ring. A coffee parasite has been discovered in Hawaii. And, of course, we have our Hick Watch and our Taser Watch.
Fantastic. That is all on the way, ladies and gentlefolk.
Can I ask you something before we go to the news here? Okay. Somebody in the text box said something, and this is absolutely true. He came up with, what the hell was up with Dutch and the cat? Okay, now you remember on the Shield, there was this whole thing with where Dutch...
Spoiler.
Where Dutch killed a cat.
Yes.
Basically just to see what it was like to kill something.
Yes.
Well, I kept thinking we get to the season finale and he's hauled in this kid who he's convinced is a serial killer. And yet there's also the kid ostensibly has been trying to implicate Dutch as the serial killer. And didn't you find yourself wondering if it was going to turn out that Dutch really did it?
No, I never because wondered.
Because it
that.
Seemed like they laid this weird groundwork for something with the cat killing that never really went anywhere.
They never paid off the cat killing thing, but then on the other hand, I think that in a way you can say it's sort of unsatisfying because they have this weird episode where he strangles a cat because he... Is that the episode where he spent the whole hour interrogating the guy about why he killed and at the end... Because the guy wants to know himself. The serial killer himself is like, tell me why I did it. And they at the end, they realize there is no explanation.
Yeah.
And so Dutch kills a cat trying to figure it out. I guess at a certain point I realized that it was a show that wasn't necessarily going to pay everything off either because either because they just realized that sometimes in life things don't get paid off or that they just had run out too many plot threads for the time and the episodes they had left and they weren't able to resolve anything. Because here's another thing and again, not even a problem because, again, not everything in life wraps up with a tidy bow. But a thing that they just sort of stopped talking about at one point was Julian being gay.
Yeah.
That just became a thing that was apparently then fine with everybody, and then it was and with his wife, and it was just never an issue again.
Well, also one of the things I thought about after the show was over, we've got Mackie. Mackie is now sentenced to work.
He's a secretary.
To work, in a cubicle for the next 3 years, and loathing that sort of thing. Can't see his kids, putting up the pictures of the family around the thing. Nothing. But you know what? Danny's back at work, and Danny still has his kid.
Right.
He's going to make her life a living hell.
Yeah, well, that's the brilliant ending that we're talking about there because it just...
They don't even actually mention that or even think about it, but when you think about it, you just go,
What's so great about it, too, is it's fantastic because it leaves it so open. Because it doesn't... In other words, I don't mean open to interpretation, but that they give you credit for being able... like a choose your own adventure book to go, wait a minute, but what about page 42? What about page 59? Oh my God, what about page 71?
And I think also with Dutch, they wanted to give, they had to pick a couple of characters, I think, to give some sort of happy closure to, since so much of it was dark. And like you had, you know, Corinne, you know, and the kids get the house. With Dutch, he gets to actually solve a serial killer case, which has always been his dream. And the woman who was the lawyer, who's Steve's lawyer that he has to deal with, is actually that actor's real life wife.
Right.
And at the end, she gives him her card, and he first kind of like fails to realize she's hitting on him. But you kind of leaving this open that maybe Dutch will actually get a woman someday after all.
You know, and not in a creepy and then you God kind of a way.
Yeah.
All right. See, I could, the problem is I could just sit and talk about the Shield like all day. So, all right. Well, in any event, in just a moment, we're going to roll our interview with Mr. Kenny Johnson. We're running kind of dangerously behind here.
Oh, sorry.
Language.
Sorry.
Make me get the swear jar. So, Michael Schaub from Bookslut.com. It's funny that I follow that up by saying Bookslut. Bookslut.com will be joining us here after the Kenny Johnson interview. Also, Sarah X. Dillon and Greg Nibbler and so forth. So without further ado, and this will be posted in the interviews section at RickEmerson.com later on today. The Terry Brooks unexpurgated interview is there, the Dave Mustaine interview, and we'll be adding this one as well. This is going to be us interviewing Mr. Kenny Johnson right here on the Emerson News Network. Our next guest has appeared on TV series such as Smallville, Saving Grace, and Cold Case, and on the first five seasons of The Shield, playing Detective Curtis Lemansky. He can currently be seen on the original series Sons of Anarchy, which airs Tuesdays on FX, and which you really ought to be watching. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show, Mr. Kenny Johnson. Hello, sir. How are you today?
Good, man. I'm doing great. How are you, Rick?
I am fantastic. Right here alongside Don Taylor, who is my co-host, and who, I have to say, did a little giddy dance when I told her that we were going to be having this interview, because she actually just finished, I believe, last night, watching The Shield, and so she saw your character from the very beginning all the way through to the end of season five, and then the ramifications beyond. So she was excited.
I was. He told me I couldn't keep just going "Lem" over and over again, because that made me seem kind of pathetic, and it might embarrass me in front of you.
No, that's all right.
I have to ask you, your character in Sons of Anarchy got a real brief introduction in season two. I think it was the episode where they were sort of fortifying the clubhouse, and now reappears at the top of season three. Without giving too much away, because the series is just getting underway, what can you tell us about him as a character?
He was an ex-Marine. He is sergeant at arms up in the Tacoma SOA, and you know, he had a past with Tig, and they used to be really close. They used to run together when they were back up there, and were in the club together back up there. So that's kind of their history, and something happened that kind of separated them, and my character kind of wants out into a vision of what she wanted to be a part of, which is kind of a smaller family, which is more like the Charming SOA. And figures, that, and with Tig, that maybe he can mend whatever differences they had in the past. So he comes down there. You know, they kind of ask him to come down there because they need some muscle, but then when he wants to get in, obviously that's a big issue for Tig. And so a lot of this season is going to be he and I going at each other.
Well, and Tig is sort of he's a little bit of a chaos factor in terms of characters, too, because you never quite get the sense from moment to moment whether he's about to do something really generous and noble or whether he's about to, like, take out a guy's eye with an ice cream scoop or something.
Bite his nose off, yeah. genitals off, who knows.
presuming that you haven't actually, like, been a gang member at any point in your life, how do you prepare to play somebody like that?
Oh, well, no, I was in a gang when I was younger, so I kind of relate. No, I'm kidding. It's so funny because I did so much research on The Shield with, on gangs and the 18th Streeters and the Lost Mags and everything, and I spent a lot of time, talking to gangbangers and ex-gangbangers, and then I've watched a million specials on gangs, and people in prison that were in gangs. And there's something about it for them that is very family oriented, and you know, it makes them feel like they have a home. And a lot of, you know, people that are like misfits or whatever, they go to a place where they feel they can relate and they have family, and it doesn't have to be their blood family, but people that are like brothers to them. And you know, the Marines do it where they watch each other's backs, the cops do it. And, you know, in the same respect, I think gang members do it, or motorcycle gangs, you know. You know, I've spent a bit of time with a guy who's a Hell's Angel, and he treats me like we're best friends and we're brothers. And he consistently does that. And I never really understand why, because I know him, but I don't know him. But at the same time, it's like that's the kind of brotherhood that they have, you know. And so, you know, they kind of look at it more like, you know, you're my brother than like a gang, you know. So I kind of just kind of, you know, try to parallel the same feelings.
I read in an interview that when you first started on Sons of Anarchy, basically your first few days, the first couple of episodes, really, you just sort of stood around in the background and were just kind of there and weren't quite sure what it was your character was going to be doing in the future. But also that you like to do a lot of research for characters, and you spend a lot of time doing your own backstory. So how do you prepare for a character when you yourself don't actually know where the showrunners are going to be taking him?
I just make it up. And whether it matches, it doesn't match. You always think that, as long as there's something going on, like a movie in my mind about my whole past and where I am and what relation everyone is here to me, it fills my life. And until I know more information from the writers, I kind of just go with that. And sometimes, it might not be spot on for what the writers are thinking, but it makes it more interesting because it doesn't always have to match exactly, the situation.
That actually dovetails with something I wanted to ask, which is, I won't spoil anything, but it's become clear that Sons of Anarchy is one of those shows where no one is really safe. When you're on a show like that, how much advance warning does someone have that their character is going to get killed off?
I don't know.
As someone who has had that experience yourself.
I mean, is that...
Yeah. Thanks for reminding me, man. If they repeat that real quick, I'm going to be pretty pissed off. But,
well, I'm not trying to imply that I know anything you don't know. I'm just... I always wonder if that's a thing where you're just kind of sitting around the, you know, craft services, and then a guy comes by and goes, "Hey, man, have you seen page 49? I don't know. You fall into a blender, you know, or whatever."
Yeah, I mean, I can say that I think it's different for every show, and it all depends on maybe the situation with, I don't know. I mean, again, the Shield, I knew like about 4 months in advance or something like that, but I think on this show, from my understanding, is it could happen really quick. that's my understanding, what I've kind of like watched, so I you're right. Everyone's walking around like, I don't know if I'll be back. You know, who knows? You know?
I have to tell you, maybe this will not surprise you. The number of guys I know, the number of men who took Lem's death on the Shield really, really hard was really amazing. Did you get that reaction from people as well? That they were really stunned by it?
Yeah. Yeah. And it really, one of the first people that gets me emotional thinking about it, but Michael Chiklis' dad is he's a hardcore Bostonian, and that guy doesn't usually cry, and he's a tough, tough, tough guy. And he called Michael up when he saw that episode, and he just was like going, "Why?" Like, he was so upset. He's like, "Why him? Why can't he? Why? What the F is wrong with those writers?" He goes, "Oh, my God." And he was so devastated that Michael got emotional, started crying, because he says, "I've never seen my dad react like that." And then I talked to somebody else who was one of the hosts from Chicago. And I had gotten probably 20 calls from radio stations that next morning, and I just didn't return any calls for like a day. And then when I talked to them, the guy said, "I was so shocked that I turned off all the lights in my house when I stood there in the dark." And he goes, "I felt like it was weird. I mean, the way it affected different people, you know, it affected me, you know, because you never know how people follow your character and how it's going to affect them. But I know that was Sean's intention, that he was hoping that you know, killing the conscience of these guys would affect people, and I guess it did that, you know.
Speaking of people following your character, if I'm correct, and I might have this wrong, but it's my understanding that Saving Grace was canceled, and Saving Grace was terrific. Saving Grace was canceled not because of ratings. TNT actually wanted to renew it, but because Fox thought it was too expensive. And I was wondering, how does that feel for you as an actor to know you actually have the numbers? You have people watching you, but, you know, it's a business decision.
I mean, I've seen it happen before, as well as, you know, other friends of mine. I was on a show in 2000 that did really well in the ratings, and they had a new president come in and took off all the new shows that the prior people had put on the air, and they were doing really good in the ratings. But, you know, sometimes they like to just start, you know, all new stuff. So, I've experienced it to that degree. And then this one, you know, basically, you know, that's what Fox said, but I know they were going to pick it up and go year to year. And I think, or somebody wanted to go year to year, and somebody wanted to do a 2-year pickup. So basically, they kind of argued about, you know, one said, I just want to go year to year. The other one says, I want to do 2 years because we want to guarantee syndication, because it was at the fourth and fifth season, which would have been, they would have been guaranteed syndication, which they would have made a lot of their money back. And I think they just got nervous. And when the other one wouldn't do it, they just, they kind of basically, for about a month and a half, they butted heads and then canceled it.
That must be really frustrating for you, though, you know, being on the artistic end, just waiting for your fate to be decided by the suits.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's the nature of the business, and you know, you, unfortunately, you can't get emotionally invested in that part of it, because there's absolutely nothing you can do. And if you just walk away angry or upset, you know what I mean? It just is a waste of your energy. You just have to see, like, that's just another decision that maybe you don't agree with, and it's too bad. But at that point, you know, there's absolutely nothing you can do, you know? And so, you know, I tried to just, you know, Holly and I talked about it, and we're just like, oh, well, you know, I mean, that was it. I mean, we put a lot into it, and that was a very emotionally, you know, challenging show. And it goes both ways. It's too bad, but at the same time, we're lucky that we went that far and got to do what we did and say what we said, you know.
We're talking to Mr. Kenny Johnson. You can see him on Sons of Anarchy, which airs on FX. When you're working on shows like these, Sons of Anarchy really is just quite an exceptional program. Does it make it hard to work on other projects, in the sense that it's a good problem to have, I suppose, but do you find yourself comparing everything else you audition for, everything else you read for, to, you know, this great work that you're doing on Sons of Anarchy, or the work you've done on The Shield?
Well, you know, for me, like, The Shield was great writing. I mean, awesome characters and incredible writing. And after I left The Shield, I probably took, you know, there were like 35 projects people wanted me to come in for, and I think I only would come in for 3 of them, just because the writing, to me, if it wasn't going to be as good or equal or as good, I just didn't want to, you know, you can't really do that for yourself or your career, I feel. So I kind of held out for something that I felt was worthy, you know, for as an actor. And so, you know, I thought the pilot of Saving Grace was really great, which I wanted to do that. But when I left that, and I got a call from Kurt and from John Landgraf, saying that they might, you know, use me over on Sons of Anarchy, I got excited, because Kurt was one of the Shield writers, and I know he's a great writer, and I'd seen the first season of Sons of Anarchy, and I loved it. I loved the writing. I loved what the whole concept was, and I totally dug the relationship. So I was lucky enough to go, you know, kind of right into Kurt's show. You know, and again, the writing's great. His writing is so, so good. And it's kind of familiar to me, because it feels a bit, you know, not like The Shield, but there's a familiar, you know, it's familiar. And it's great. It's real. It's very real to me. And, you know, so I love it because of that fact.
You also got to do one episode of Lie to Me, because Sean Ryan is the showrunner over at Lie to Me.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have overlapping work days with some of your other colleagues? Because you played, I'm assuming a few days work. You played a small role as a gay photographer. Did you have overlapping days with some of your, and how did that come together? How awesome was that?
That was cool and funny. Yeah. I didn't look at the part when I told them that I would do it because they said it was a big Shield reunion. So I thought, well, anything for Sean, of course. And, yeah, I was nervous. It actually came out. It worked, but I was nervous doing it because I thought, well, okay, am I going to be believable? You know, are people going to buy this? But it worked. It was cool. It was good. Now, I mean, when I got the script, I read all the other characters, and I'm like, oh, man, he probably wants me for that guy. I'm like, no, it's probably that guy. Look at that. This is a great role. And I called halfway through it. I'm like, which role am I? Am I this guy or that guy? They go, no, you're this guy called so-and-so. And I'm like, oh, I haven't got there yet, you know? I turn like two pages, and there's that scene, and I'm like, is this a joke? I go, you know, but I did it, and it was fun, and I had the time, so it was cool.
We're talking with Kenny Johnson. I'm always curious to know, anyone who works in a creative field, whether they're a writer, an actor, musician, if there was something in particular, a moment for you where you sort of realized, like, this is what I want to do with my life. This is what I want to pursue. Whether it was somebody you saw acting on stage or a film or a television program you saw, and you said, that's what I want to do. That's the job for me.
You know, I mean, when I was in college, I definitely, you know, played around with the idea, but I was, you know, I was fairly introverted, and I didn't think I could ever put myself out there like that. You know, but I used to watch old James Dean, Montgomery Clift movies, you know, Marlon Brando, and I totally loved the old movies. And, I think the time that it actually happened for me was a friend of mine who used to be Stallone's friend, wrote a movie. And it was like a student film when he was in college. So I was like a few years older than him. It was when I first moved out here, and he just wrote this film and wrote me as his best friend in the film, and kind of brought it to me and said, "Look, I wrote this film. I'm going to put it in the festival. I want you to play this part together, lead guy." And so that's kind of like, I didn't want to do it at the beginning because I said I don't know anything about this, but he talked me into it, and that was my first experience actually doing anything on film, and I kind of fell in love with it at that moment. I just had this like, I don't know, this enlightened moment that just kind of shot through me, and I didn't know what it was, but it kind of let me know that this was where I was supposed to go. So,
in addition to this season of Sons of Anarchy, what's on the horizon for you? What else can we expect from you in the immediate future?
I just finished a film called Few Options with this guy George Pappy Jr. wrote and directed it. It was his first feature, and Michael Sheen is in it, and Rainn Wilson, Brad Dourif, David Marciano from The Shield, Laura San Giacomo, and Dayton Cowley, actually, who's also on Sons of Anarchy. And it's an interesting story about a guy. I play a guy who's been in prison 23 years, and it's basically the first 8 days that happens when he first gets out of prison. And a bunch of crazy stuff happens, but that's kind of what the film's based on.
Sons of Anarchy airs Tuesdays on FX, and you can find out more about it at fxnetworks.com. Mr. Kenny Johnson, thank you for spending some time with us and for doing such great work, one project after another, and it sounds like there are more great things on the horizon. So best of continued success in life, art, and all things, my friend.
Thank you very much, man. It's a pleasure being on, and I appreciate it very much.
Right into this world, all alone. God takes your soul, you're on your own. The crow flies straight, a perfect line. On the devil's bed, until you die. This life is short. Better live it right. You ain't coming back. Gotta run.
gotta look this world in the eye. Gotta live this life till you die. You better have soul, nothing less. But when it's business time, it's life or death. The king is dead, the light goes on. You'll lose your head when the deal goes down. But keep your eye on the road ahead. Gotta live this life. Gotta live this world in the eye. I gotta live this life.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. That was Curtis Stigers, by the way. So that was This Life, which is the theme to Sons of Anarchy, which is the new program on FX. Your hair is doing some really weird things over there right now. You got like a full Pippi Longstocking thing going on.
Well, you know, I groom and I blow dry and all of those things most mornings. Not every morning, as you know, but most mornings. But then the headphones, then I get headphone head and I have crazy bag lady headphone hair.
And I wasn't judging. I was just making the observation.
Yes,
I was judging a little bit.
You were.
I was really judging it.
I saw it in your eyes.
Damn my eyes. Okay. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. Don't forget, coming up later on in this hour, we will be talking to Sarah X. Dillon and Greg Nibbler. Fun Employment Radio nearing its 200th episode today. And somebody texted me and they asked if that Kenny Johnson interview was going to be streaming. So it's, when the Today Show is done, obviously today's episode and Legion of News will both stream via rickemerson.com. At this point, pretty much throughout the weekend, and then that'll be in the archive section of the rickemerson.com site with all the other interviews, Dave Mustaine and et cetera, with the Terry Brooks thing and whatnot. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Friday.
An underground brewery tunnel has been revealed. Portland police have busted a check fraud ring. And Sunday is going to be a day that if you live in Portland, there are many, many exciting food things you can do.
Awesome. There's also something else. Is there some other large-ish thing that we need to be doing before the end of today's show? Stupid Criminal of the Week.
Oh, yes, that's the thing I keep forgetting. We have Stupid Criminal of the Week.
So we have a Stupid Criminal of the Week coming up and quite possibly a Taser Watch if we have time. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to jam a whole lot into a little here.
And, of course, that the billboard.
Yes, and a billboard, which I'll be getting to.
Yeah.
It's 503-505-6964. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show, Michael Schaub. He is the managing editor of Bookslut.com. Hello, sir.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
I am fantastic. I had this whole quote that I was going to open with, and that ship has sort of sailed. So I'll say it. We'll say it, and then retrospectively, we will just imagine that I said it before bringing you on. Groucho Marx had this great thing he said one time where he said that outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. But inside of a dog, of course, it is too dark to read. And then I was going to lead into a long, it's going to conflate into a whole thing about you being a firewall against the ongoing inferno of linguistic ignorance. It was just like more of my like babbling garbage. So we will skip to the point where I ask you, bookslut.com.
Yes.
Somebody asked me, I think they were confusing it with somebody else. I think they were actually confusing it with a site that perhaps one visits alone in the privacy of one's home. And they asked if it was perhaps an outlet for some of the finer adult materials. And I was at pains to explain to them that it was not. But you guys, I described you as a site for book reviews and literary criticism, which kind of makes it sound more highbrow than it is. And I mean that as a knock, but I mean it's not the, but it's just a place online where you guys just review books by like the thousands.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's more of a casual, it's not a snobby sort of highbrow. I mean, our writers have a casual style, and it's, you know, more telling your friends what they should be reading rather than giving a lecture at some private university. You know, it's a lot more casual than that.
One of the reviews that I first noticed is your review of the book Girl Power, The 90s Revolution in Music. This is a great quote. You started off the review by saying, There are probably at least 1,000 ways to write about popular music, and the vast majority of them are effing awful. Which is just the sort of bracing honesty one doesn't necessarily find in, like, the New York Times review of books. Do you ever just, I mean, do, here's a question I have. If you're a book reviewer, I think I know the answer to this, but publishers just, they just, like, send you stuff by the pallet, right?
Oh,
I mean,
God,
by
yeah.
the metric ton.
Oh, God, yeah. It's
where does it all go? Do you have like a special huge repository in which they deposit it? They can't just bring it to your house or something.
They bring it to our 2-bedroom apartment in Foster Powell, and it's the books have actually just taken over the
in Foster
most
Powell.
Of the
do people
room.
Even recognize whether you're, what you're being brought? Do they think it's a new kind of TV dinner?
Yeah, it's something.
I don't know. A lot of squarish things came in the mail. Let's see what they taste like. They are high
posters?
In fiber. So anyway, I'm sorry. So they just bring you these things by the ton
so
to your
many.
House?
Yeah, to the house. Yeah, and there's. I mean, there's probably about 1,500 to 2,000 there right now, just sort of taking over everything.
Are you ever tempted just to go, well, look, I mean, nobody will miss these if they just sort of turn up at Powell's, maybe in the newly released section, and if I'm given some money for these. Yeah. Is there a book critic code of ethics where like you can't stick them in the back of your pickup and sell them?
Well, Bookslut can't, but our sister porn site that you were talking about earlier, that absolutely
awesome.
Can.
Someone
yeah.
legally
not
distinct from but
there.
Similar to you. Well done.
And I will say, as someone who has reviewed books for book sites and who has reviewed movies for DVD sites, there's nothing to stop the people who do the reviews from later on, you know, taking those things to Powell's or wherever.
See,
and
just,
offloading them to, you know.
I mean, just working at a radio station, I can say this now, when I was working for CBS, it's like they would just, I mean, we were just like, you know, we were just a radio station that just, you know, that I don't even think they knew who we were. They just knew they saw us in a media guide somewhere and they just added it to the list and stuff would just arrive every day. And, you know, about every 5 or 6 weeks, you would just see someone leaving the building with a nondescript box and then heading downtown. How do you decide what you're going to review? I mean, you got 2,000 books in your house.
Yeah.
Do you just flip through until you find a cover that looks that is particularly shiny and say to yourself, well, this looks this held my attention. I guess I'll read it.
It's the ones with the $100 bills tucked inside the pages. I mean, those go to the top of the line. But after that, it's more just.
Do publishers lean on you to really review specific books?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Do they call you like, look, what do I have to offer you to get you to read, you know, whatever?
Yeah, they've become really. Really good with the hard sell. You know, you'll get 6 copies of the same book in an email every day from the publicist. And it's pretty unending. And you just sort of have to learn to ignore a lot of it.
You always hear about, you know, guys who are like, you know, like musicians or even some TV creators. Like I know David Simon from The Wire was this way. Where he would call up, like if someone wrote a negative review of The Wire, he would find their number.
Oh, God.
And he would call them. And they would answer, you know, hello, you know, City Desk, and this is David Simon. What the F is your problem? But I mean, like, publishers, do they, if you write a really bad review, do you hear about it? Like, do they ring you up and they're like, hey, I'm at HarperCollins. What gives?
No, not the publishers. The authors do sometimes. Although it hasn't really happened to me, at least in a while. But some of our reviewers get kind of beaten up in the press by authors. It's such a bad idea, you know, to go after a reviewer for a negative review. But
well, it is considered bad form, and it just makes the author look like just a huge dick.
Exactly, yeah.
Like especially people, authors who come in on, like, the Amazon comments and then respond to people who didn't like their book. Going, well, you just didn't understand it. What's wrong with you? And you're like, wow, you're not making your case,
please,
sir.
Please tell me that's not a theoretical example. Please tell me that actually happens.
No, that really happens.
Because I was
really
wondering
does.
What I was going to look at online that I didn't. So now. Now, there needs to be some site that just archives nothing but like author flame wars on Amazon with reviewers, which would
idea.
Be awesome. Well, because like I was talking about the World of Television, Aaron Sorkin had this well publicized dust up with I think they were then called Mighty Big TV before they were Television Without Pity.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
Television Without Pity really really loved him, and then in the third season they stopped, and suddenly Aaron Sorkin appeared. He was like lurking the whole time, I guess, and he just appeared out of nowhere, like kaja, like the great Gazoo, and just got into this land war with the people at Television Without Pity, which he then wrote into this whole episode of The West Wing. But I mean, you get your guy. I was going to say James Fry. He seems like a bad example because I don't really know that he's in a position to pick a fight with anybody. But you must get authors that are a little persnickety to deal with sometimes. Has anybody ever contacted you?
Yeah, there's an author named Toby Young who contacted me one time. He was wrote a book called How to Lose Friends and Alienate People.
Oh,
I think.
Right. No, he's a dick.
Oh,
he's
my God. Yeah. He's a complete dick.
Oh,
yeah.
No, F him. No,
yeah.
I read.
Yeah. I'm so glad you agree with me on this, man.
I say as though that differentiates him from like any number of other people I know. Do you know who Toby Young is?
No.
He is, correct me if I'm wrong here, but he is one of those guys that seems to have been beamed out of one of those how to get laid seminars that like Tom Cruise teaches in Magnolia, or like the game guy.
Those NLP people?
Exactly.
But
I actually have to say, I'm not even really aware. I don't even really know what the book is that he wrote, but there was a huge article about him in, like, I don't know, like GQ or something, just talking about what a raging dick he was. Like, apart from his work,
completely.
Just how he himself was just an ass. Please to explain.
Yeah. He sent me an email that was, I can't remember exactly what it says, but it was sort of a, this was about 6 or 7 years ago, but sort of something like, I don't care about your review, that I just emailed you about. And just real unpleasant. And I think, later I think it was last season maybe, he was a guest judge on Top Chef for a while.
What is his book, though?
Which drove me crazy.
What was the book that he wrote?
I think it was called How to Lose Friends and Alienate People. And it was about his time working for Graydon Carter at, I believe, The New Yorker.
Was it a memoir or was it like a thinly veiled novel?
It was a memoir. And just about what a jerk he had been and how he, kind of delighted being a jerk.
It was one of those things where he was a jerk, but but therefore was like a badass.
Exactly, yeah.
He didn't care about society's conventions or constraints, and people couldn't take his blunt brand of honesty.
That's right.
And then he was, Don really, you would have loved him because he was another guy that, he referred to, If I'm correct in this memory, and I may not be, but I do believe I read an interview with him somewhat later. The British have these things called tea cozies. Have a beer cozy over there somewhere.
Yeah.
He referred to, in less charitable terms, the fairer sex operating as, in effect, the penis cozies.
Yeah.
And that he found that that's when his relationships worked best, is when they just sort of were in that role. He was really just a prize.
He
was just buff to a high shine.
100% class.
I mentioned James Frye earlier, and he's the Million Little Pieces guy,
yes.
Right? And a lot of people did, of almost everybody did, but you wrote a real positive review of that book.
Oh, yeah. Loved it.
What happens when you write a review of like A Million Little Pieces and then it turns out that he just pulled it out of his ass? I mean, do you feel like you have to go back and put a little thing at the beginning like, sorry about this, I didn't know.
I was tempted to, actually. And I think one of the worst things for me about that was like there was a line in the review that was like, this book is so honest, or something.
Yeah.
One of those things that I instantly regretted as soon as that.
Because he's at home cackling and rubbing his hands together.
Exactly, yeah. But I really did like the book. I thought it would have been a great novel, I think, and I think he actually wanted originally to make it a novel. His publisher pushed him into making it a memoir, straight ahead memoir. There are definitely ones like that where I kind of wish I could go back and maybe revisit what I wrote about it. But
we're talking to Michael Schaub of Bookslut.com, and that is spelled just like it sounds, by the way, all one word, Bookslut.com. And you were on Outlook Portland,
yes,
recently, and we discussed this, but we should probably delve into a little bit here. So why is it called Bookslut.com? Where does that name come from?
It was the founder of the site, Jessa Crispin. It was her idea, and she just wanted to we just published our 100th issue, and Jessa talks about the name a little bit in it, saying her phrasing was she wanted a name that was sort of gunslinger and sort of a go F yourself kind of name, and something that was a little confrontational, and it maybe was more so at the time. This was 8 years ago, but just, something that would indicate, someone who enjoys reading all kinds of things and isn't, tied into a scene or doesn't really read to impress people, just reads what she or he wants. And it was just meant to be kind of a fun name, to sort of, make people realize we're having fun with it and that this wasn't going to be.
So it's not going to be, I only read books about Victorian carpentry.
Exactly, which I do, but Jessa doesn't, and she had the naming rights.
Well, so there you go. Yeah. So you're covering the whole spectrum.
That's right.
It was a big, broad question, but one of the things that we get asked all the time, Don and I were just talking about this, is people are always going, hey, what should I be reading right now?
Oh, sure.
Which is a huge question, like so much so that you almost can't even answer it, but so I don't even know where one begins, but what are you reading right now that you're really into?
What I just finished reading this really great novel called Skippy Dies by Paul Murray, who's a young Irish writer, and it's about a boys in a Catholic high school in Dublin in the late 90s, and it's just sort of a surreal kind of funny novel. It's almost I don't even know how to describe it. Almost like Yves Lenoir meets Monty Python or something. You know, that didn't really get close to it. But it's just a really funny, really likable novel. And I survived 12 years of Catholic school, so it's kind of
well done,
you know?
Sir.
Yeah,
excellent.
Middle.
And then do you read much nonfiction, or are you more of a fiction guy? Like, when you're left to your own devices?
Left to my own devices, I probably read about half and half. You know, I'm reading a book right now called Poisoning the Press. That's about a feud between Richard Nixon and Jack Anderson. Although that feud
really
makes it sound a little more innocuous than it was. You know, Nixon's plumbers tried to have him killed.
Oh, yeah.
Anderson killed. And so it's about that. And,
No, you're speaking my language. When you say, here's the thing. Like, in my head, Nixon is like a hyperlinked keyword. Anything that says Nixon, it's like it just gets flagged and it goes into the forefront of my attention. In a sort of perverse way, I love Richard Nixon
because
he's just one of the most fascinating people that ever lived. All right, hold on. Poisoning the Press.
Poisoning the Press by Mark Feldstein.
It's funny what I was just reading the other day. Actually, I was just. This makes me sound like a serial killer or whatever. So I'm sorry for that. The other day I was just thumbing through G. Gordon Liddy's autobiography, Will. I swear to God, I don't mean to put this image in your head, but it was. I swear to God, it was like bathroom reading, and so. You know, some people, you know, like, I don't get Reader's Digest or anything.
But
there's nothing wrong with that.
He's talking about how they were planning, how he offered to kill Jack Anderson. Yeah. He's reciting this, and I told the president that if he needed Anderson taken care of, I would do it. He offered to walk up to him and just shoot him in the head. And then Liddy, because he's nuts and, like, fantastic and weird and horrible, he said, not only would he walk up and just shoot Jack Anderson in the head, which has got to be an interesting thing to read in a book later if you're Jack Anderson.
Yeah.
But then Liddy then said, and so there would be no loose ends, he said, and if you want, I'll walk to a corner across the street and then somebody can come up and shoot me in the head immediately afterward. You just let me know. Say the word. That's after they rejected the first plan, which is, I swear to Christ, to cover Jack Anderson's steering wheel with LSD so he would go nuts and, like, his car would careen out of control.
Yeah.
You just don't get that anymore. Obama's not planning anything like that we know of. I mean, it's like he's not that interesting.
You know, Cheney had a lot of plans like that.
Yeah,
though.
But that's why the villain is
Cheney
always
had a lot
more
of that
interesting.
Going on.
Vader is always more interesting than Luke. That's just a fact. All right, Poisoning the Press. Poisoning the Press. Excellent. But it documents the whole kind of.
In the whole era, the whole weird paranoid era. Of Liddy holding his hand over the flame and eating a cockroach or whatever. I mean, just that whole weird part of American history. You know, that I was born in 1977, so I don't really remember any of it. But it's so fascinating to go back and read. And I'm kind of obsessed with pop culture. And Nixon has become such a huge figure in American pop culture, well, in the worldwide pop culture, that it's just kind of cool to read about what an insane paranoiac he actually really was.
He was just nuts. I mean, he was just that whole that. And he was nuts, like, from way back. That story you read about how Pat Nixon wouldn't go out with him, and so he just instead chauffeured her on dates with other guys.
Yeah.
Which is just, like, horrible and creepy and sad.
Yeah.
And I guess admirable, because I guess he got her in the end, sort of. You know, like, he did win her heart in a horrible sort of Nixon kind of way. I mean,
great decision on her part, too.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, so that's just, and it was just a strange time in American history, definitely.
Oh, God, it sounds so fascinating. Yeah.
Don Taylor, what are you reading right now?
Sadly, I'm actually reading Furious Love, the book about Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton.
Why is that sad?
Because it's not very good. I mean, it's factual, I guess, but it's kind of fawning, you know, and it's sort of if you're reading a biography of someone and at the end of each page, it wouldn't be out of place for them to just write, and they were awesome.
Yeah.
Then you know that you're not probably really getting the whole story.
They hovered above the ground.
Yeah.
I'll finish this by. Is that the only thing you're currently reading? Because you multitask books, I would imagine.
Yeah, I usually have a nonfiction and a fiction book going at the same time. I can't remember what I did read just something fictional, but I can't remember.
I just finished speaking of a book that you read, but the whole time you're going like, this is awful. And I mean, to me, there's two kinds of awful. There's the sort of, this is an odd thing to say. There's Flowers in the Attic awful.
Yeah.
Which I find actually gets kind of a bad rap, I will say, in that when I first read Flowers in the Attic, which I wanted to do because it's a big part of pop culture, such a touchstone, and it wasn't nearly as bad as I've been primed to believe. I mean, it was not great, but it wasn't like atrocious.
Right.
It wasn't like Twilight Bad, which I found not only was thin, it was just poorly written. It was just terrible. Like the misuse of the language, it just clanked on the ear. But a book that I read that was really Twilight Bad, but that I finished the entire thing. It was that new Ben Mezrich book, The Accidental Billionaires,
right?
Which is what Sorkin adapted into The Social Network, the new Fincher film. And it's an awful book.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, so that Social Network, which is the movie about Facebook, is adapted from this Ben Mezrich book. He's the guy who wrote Bringing Down the House, which they made into 21 with Kevin Spacey. It's a terrible book.
Oh, okay.
It's terrible.
Bringing Down the House was a terrible book.
It's
too.
Worse. It's so much worse than that. And that was but you know, I read it anyway because I'm a big nerd for Aaron Sorkin. And
Aaron Sorkin's great, yeah.
And I actually, not me, someone legally distinct from me, but separate from me, but a lot like me, but not me, but that guy. He has a copy of the Aaron Sorkin script for The Social Network, and he'll be reading that this weekend. But the Mezrich book is bad. It's bad like month-old halibut bad because you can tell he just made everything up. You can tell he just made that up like lock, stock, and barrel in my constitutionally protected opinion, like he did with Bringing to the House, as the Boston Globe discovered. So anyway, that's bad. It's no good at all. So I'm washing that out of my mouth with the brackish taste of my palate with that book Stylized, which is a history of the strunken white elements of style that Dawn lent me. And I am slowly working my way through Catch-22, which I have never read, and which Lara is a freak for. And she has been pushing me to read Catch-22 forever, and I am reading it. At the risk of sounding heretical, I am not enjoying it, but I am reading it. I will make it through. I'm not saying it's a bad book. I'm saying it's not. It is not meshing well with my particular needs as a reader, but that's okay. I will endeavor. I will finish it. Maybe my assessment may change halfway through. Who knows? So there you go. And so forth. And I apologize. We got so far behind today. We were talking about Kenny. I mentioned we had the Kenny Townsend.
Yeah, that's so great.
You watched The Shield.
I love The Shield. Yeah.
He tells this is going to be up on the show later. I will. I'll send a link to you so you can listen to this. But he talked about Michael Chiklis's dad actually called him on the phone and berated him because the show spoiler killed off Lem with the hand grenade. And he's like, Michael, what kind of program do you work on? So anyway, do you watch Sons of Anarchy?
I still haven't seen Sons of Anarchy, although I'm looking forward to it.
It's fantastic. It's great.
It's Katie Sagal is in there, right?
Katie Sagal, and she is awesome. Katie Sagal, Ron Perlman, Adam Arkin, who is Alan Arkin's son.
Wow.
He was in The West Wing. And then Henry Rollins, at one point,
really plays
a neo-Nazi, which is sort of like the role he was born to play.
Right. He's actually a really good actor, Rollins.
Surprisingly. I just saw him again the other day. I was flipping around. I'm like, Heat or something was on. Where Al Pacino was like picking him up and tossing him around, which is hilarious. It's fantastic. So we'll have to have you back on at some point. We got more time.
Absolutely.
Here.
Thank you very much.
The website is bookslut.com. Michael Schaub is the managing editor of bookslut.com, spelled just like it sounds. So you want to go seek that at bookslut.com. On the other side, we will return with more up to and including Greg Nibbler and Sarah Dillon, who will be here to talk about the 200th anniversary. I keep saying anniversary, which makes it sound like they're, you know, like it's a Methuselah sort of a thing. They will be here to talk about the 200th episode of Fun Employment Radio. Isn't that right, Dawn Taylor?
Yes, indeed.
You know,
what?
Dawn Taylor, that
yes.
section of the program, not unlike everything else, you know who that's brought to you by?
Would that be the cleaning solution?
The cleaning solution, that is Mr. Michael Beatty, 971-533-3211. You can find out more about him at 971-533-3211. We will have more about the cleaning solution later on in this half hour. Greg Nibbler and Sarah Dillon on the way, and more news from Dawn Taylor, including Stupid Criminal of the Week and the Taser Watch. Stay there. We return after this. You are listening to The Rick Emerson Show on the Emerson News Network. Don't go anywhere. Here it echo park. Indeed, you are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program right here on the Emerson News Network. Brought to you by a variety of folks, including but not limited to Mr. Michael Beatty of The Cleaning Solution. You can find out more about him. You can find out all that he does, all the services he provides. And you might want to write the number down, like, you know, just to have handy. 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. Because one can never tell, I mean, just theoretically speaking, if somebody, let's say, it was looking for an adult beverage of some kind to consume, maybe a beer. Let's say they opened the refrigerator, not unlike a sort of alcoholic old Mother Hubbard, but found that the cupboard was bare, there was no beer. There was a bottle of something that I think was later revealed to be Kahlua, but that sort of looked like 30-weight motor oil. And if that were to stain the carpet in some way, not that that would ever happen.
No.
That would be a thing where then the responsible parties and their partners would forfeit the cleaning and security deposit, which is a thing that nobody wants.
No, that would be terrible.
In any way.
That would be horrible.
Not a thing anybody wishes to have happen. No, no, perish the thought. So what you do, just to forfend, as our Latter-day Saint brethren say, you want to write down this number. It's 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. That is the number for Mr. Michael Beatty in The Cleaning Solution. He's a longtime listener. He does stain removal, carpet repairs, and that is anything. It's not just carpet. It's upholstery, stone, marble, tile, and actually, you know, furniture as well.
So if you concrete?
Yes, probably.
Well,
AstroTurf? If you got the offset stones, flagstones. AstroTurf, maybe. Here's the thing about AstroTurf. You know, you can wash AstroTurf, you just can't dry it. Because my family, who were just a big pack of hicks, had AstroTurf all over our back porch. Hmm. And it wasn't even the green kind. It was the kind that was like a pale blue. It was interspersed with little black flecks in it. So I found that out one time. You don't want to hear this, though, because you have a thing about uncontrollable vomit that you don't like to hear about it.
No, I'm really not fine. I mean, but, you know, I can hear about it. It won't make me, you know.
You're the exception to the stomach emptying rule on this program about vomit.
I find it unpleasant, but I can listen.
You know who else finds
it? For the love of God, tell me the story.
No, I'll just say that there's somebody else who finds that vomit unpleasant, and it's the guy, and by guy I mean me, who has to pick up the square of AstroTurf from the backyard where my brother had it just been chain puking. And then I had to run it, you know, through the wash. You don't want to hear about it.
No, yeah, you're right.
See, but
I
here's
don't.
The thing. I'm not suggesting you should call Michael Beatty just the next time there's vomit somewhere. I mean, that would seems like it would be cruel and probably pointless and really cost you. I mean, it would be a disproportionate investment of your money.
And unfair to him.
Yeah, I mean, he probably cares less about that because he's making money. His number is 971-533-3211. That's how you can contact Mr. Michael Beatty, proprietor of The Cleaning Solution, a locally owned and operated business. 971-533-3211. Michael Beatty at The Cleaning Solution. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6969. 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. In just a moment, we will have more news from Don Taylor. Don Taylor, what headlines are you tracking for the good people of Portland today?
An underground brewery tunnel has been reopened. We got a whole lot of food things to do this Sunday. And a man escaped from jail and then was caught sneaking back in.
You kind of sounded like Pete Puma just there.
Did
he
I?
Said a whole lot of...
I'm modeling myself on our president, Barack Obama, who says, well, you know, there's going to be folks who are going to, you know, et cetera. Because I'm trying to sound more folksy so people will find me likable.
Just round off the edges of your words. You know,
because as I know, as we know from the emails we received yesterday, people consider me vicious.
Yes. Yes. No. And don't say emails. Say email. And
that there were two emails. One likes me because I'm vicious. The other unsubscribed because we are vicious.
You know, there's no need to be. There's no need for martyrdom about this. They were lumping me in with you, by the way.
But the word vicious was used in both.
I've got this. Let's see. Where did it? I've actually got one of those emails head. It was a guy who actually said, and this may be a reaction to the fact that he just returned by his own admission from Burning Man. And he, you know, he described himself as being sort of a half hippie, half geek. Let's see. It says, let's see if I've got it. Oh, here we go. This is from Matt. And Matt says, the subject line is, I said, I'd like to send you a note of opinion about the show after spending a week away from it at Burning Man. I am half hippie, half nerd. He said, coming back with fresh ears. He said, really? This is one of the most vicious and funny and pure versions of your programs I have ever heard. He said, Donna works very well as your co-host and is wicked and focused in every way. So there you go. He said, however, though, I also cannot deny my undiminished love for Sarah X. Dillon. Hey, speaking of that, let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Radio program, Sarah X. Dillon and Greg Nibbler, Fun Employment Radio. Hello there.
Hello.
All right, I got to make sure these
can
microphones
you hear us?
Are...
Can you
wait,
my
who's...
Mic,
where's Chester? Where's Chester?
I am with Chester. I'm Chester.
All right, there you go. All
Greg
right.
is Anita.
Anita.
Hello, how are you guys?
Doing good. It's always so fun to see you guys.
Hello.
And we brought Donna present. Too.
Yes.
And by present, do you mean?
Beer.
Ah, yes. Excellent. Well done.
There you go, Miss Taylor.
Thank you.
Sorry about drinking some of your Kahlua. Don, sorry about drinking some of your Kahlua.
It was very delicious, but both Greg and I did not feel so. It was just too sugary, like very, very sweet.
Well, I didn't drink a lot of it because it was like I was having a bad day. And I drank the first one. I was like, this is delicious, but it's very thick. And then Rick said, you pour in more of it. And I was like, still having a bad day. And I drank a little more. Then finally, it was the point where I just went, I don't feel good now.
Yeah, I think it's better as a mix.
Yeah, we were cutting it with water. That's when you feel kind of crazy with coffee mugs.
And it was like, it was on the day where she went to the fridge because she was. I forget why you'd even been having such a bad day. I don't even really remember what, if something in particular, if you just came in sort of feeling off kilter. But you're like, today of all days, I really am glad that there's a fridge filled with ice cold beer that I can. And you opened it and you didn't even say anything. It was just like a vacuum of sound for a moment, like a perfect sort of void in space, just sort of a. And then you just said. It was like a guttural, primal, wounded animal noise.
Yeah.
There's no beer.
There are a bunch of winos in this building, though, I've noticed. Have you noticed all the bottles of wine in the fridge?
Now, I just sort of, no offense. I just assume that any alcohol here is maybe not yours as such, but that it's related to your program that perhaps a guest.
No, there were bottles of wine in the fridge when we first moved in.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, but they're still there.
I don't think we've ever had wine on the show, have we?
No wine, I don't think.
Yeah.
Whiskey, definitely.
Well, yeah.
Well, this fine cold Rainier Ale is quite delicious.
What do you call it? Rainier?
Fine Rainier.
Fine Rainier.
French imported.
Only the best for you. Mm. When we were talking to Greg Proops, though, yesterday, we were so trying to be fancy pants that we actually went to the store and bought Fancy Bear.
Yeah.
Oh, is that why there's
local
full
Oregon
sale
beer.
That's
there
why there's full sale.
So we could look a little classier. But then he showed up early and we were still drinking our Mickey. So the whole classy thing was thrown out.
Well, and then he just asked for tea.
Yeah.
And then he asked for Red Bush tea.
By the way, and I apologize because I drank the last, I used the last real, like the regular tea bag in there like about a month and a half ago because it was some day I forgot Vizo and I didn't know there was coffee and I was looking for anything with caffeine. So there was nothing that, but the whole illusion would have been ruined anyway because of those four big recycling bins in the kitchen, one of which is always full of Vizo and Mickey's cans. The other one is all just full of malt liquor bottles. And I know this because Anna Griffin from The Oregonian, who was here last week, I didn't realize this. She was left alone in the kitchen because we were running, running a little late. And she did a series of, like, what are those, the TwitPic things where you can tweet photos?
Oh, no.
And it was like she was doing like a sort of a mosaic of the entire place, one picture at a time. And she's like, here I'm in the Rick Emerson Show. Check out their fridge. And the fridge is just, it's empty except for a thing of like, mayonnaise and then some wine. And then, like, I think of mustard packets or something, and, like, that was it. Oh, and then that lasagna, which is just had sort of turned into, like, a furry animal.
That was Greg's. I threw it out yesterday because it was so gross.
Well, it wasn't mine. It was a gift from someone, but I wasn't hungry at the time.
From Ben, the electrician.
Which I'm sure it was amazing, but I wasn't hungry at that moment.
I've been blaming Ben for the last 2 weeks that it's been sitting in there. I thought Ben left it there.
Yeah, he left it for me. Yeah, it. Yeah, ownership was transferred to me for that.
Are you happy or sad that that Ben left it for Greg?
No, I'm fine. He offered it to me first. Okay. He offered me lasagna. Well,
you got secondhand lasagna.
And I said, no, thank you. And then it ended up in the fridge, and I was like, and then I came close to eating it, and I thought, no, but I said no, so it's not really my lasagna anymore. And then, like, a couple of days went by, and I kept going, it's still there. And by about day three, when I went, and now it's starting to look kind of dried out, and I don't want it anymore.
Yesterday when I threw it into the garbage, it made a loud clunk. It went and it was just like, bam, awesome. Like went all straight down to the bottom.
There's this, because this is the second time, I think, that Ben has offered you food and you've rejected him.
Yes, he offered me blackberry cobbler.
Warm blackberry cobbler.
You've got to say yes sometimes.
Well, you know, I'm playing hard to get.
Playing hard to get.
Teasing him.
Yeah. I think the first time, I don't know if you and I were together outside something when you met him or whatever, but maybe I'm just making this up in my head because it seems more fitting. But it was like the first. Did you say that the first time you met him, he was standing outside, like smoking a cigarette, and he's got his sleeves rolled up, and he's a good looking guy, and he's all with the Battlestar Galactica tattoo on the one arm. And so I just picture him looking like a sort of like a really nerdy, like a Comic-Con James Dean, leaning against the wall. And
he is a very nice looking young man.
He is. There are some very attractive people that work in our building.
Oh,
I have to say. There's like some rule to like work downstairs. You have to be like good looking.
Yeah, you think, you know, electricians or something, and you think a bunch of burly guys with beer guts and like a 2 day growth of beard. Like, no, very well groomed, muscular, fit, good looking people.
I did notice some new eye candy yesterday. Some new guy that I haven't seen down there before.
It's
the guy with the glasses.
Here's what I was.
Oh
yeah,
ask. Yes,
he's handsome.
I know who
because they were leading yesterday. See, I don't know if you guys were here for this. I was going to ask. This sort of conflates with my question. As Don and I were in the kitchen/green room yesterday, which we've kind of just gotten used to having, I think, to ourselves. Like, you guys are probably the same way.
Oh, yeah.
We're like,
there's no.
I mean, at maximum capacity, there are 5 businesses that can be in this building, and right now there's only, I think, 3. So Don and I were there, and we're like, we were just being profane and loud, and it's like crap strewn everywhere, and, you know, malt liquor bottles and whatever. And then the kitchen opens, and it's Donna, the office manager, who we love, who's adorable.
She's cool.
She's taking some prospective new tenants on a tour. And she's like, and this is the kitchen, and then she just, like, whisked them away. She's like, let's go to the roof. And she's just like, but Anna Griffin was here, and so she had done this shot of the inside of the fridge, which immediately went to Twitter. Then she did one of each of the recycling bins, leading up to, like, you know, plastic, paper, Mickey's, and then one is just like a big picture of Billy Dee Williams, like looking up from the bottom of the side of a Colt 45.
The 40s. That
which I think actually kind of impressed her in a way. I think she sort of thought that was great. So, in any event, in just a few, we'll talk about you guys are having your 200th episode. Are you taping that today?
Have we really been unemployed for almost a year?
Yes. Yes, we have.
Rick has been calling it the 200th anniversary all day.
I don't know why I keep doing that.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah, whatever.
No, it just kind of crept up on us. All of a sudden, you know, at 198, we're like, wait a second.
Yeah.
It's almost 200 episodes.
We've been unemployed for almost a year, and then you guys have been productive again for almost a year. And
I think Lowe said it best. Like, he actually just wrote us a song, and one of the lines in the song is, you can call us drunks, but you can't call us lazy.
Seriously.
Yeah.
So we'll talk more about that here in just a few. Without further ado, let's pay a visit to the news desk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Let's do our stupid criminal of the week.
Shall we?
Yes, let's do that.
All right, ladies and gentlefolk, it is time for stupid criminal of the week. As always, brought to you by mugshotlist.com. Our good friend and listener, Andy, runs that. Mugshotlist.com, where I swear to God, actually a team of robots just updates the sites around the clock, putting brand new mugshots up, covering 19 states and myriad counties beyond, of course, including the all-important state of Florida. So you can find out more about that at mugshotlist.com. And don't forget, stupid criminal of the week is not only sponsored by mugshotlist.com, but as part of that, he gives away a membership, a full-service membership, once per week. And this week, that goes to Mr. Mike Fielding.
Yay.
Mr. Mike Fielding. He wins a full-service membership to mugshotlist.com. So it's 19 counties in Oregon and 13 states, including Florida, Georgia, Texas, Ohio, and always adding more counties and states. Full membership gets you searchability. You can browse mugshots by categories like county and gender, and you can view an unlimited number of pages. Find out more at mugshotlist.com. Now with the details on your stupid criminal of the week, Dawn Taylor.
It's a first for McDonald County Undersheriff Bud Gow. Never has the Southwest Missouri lawman had inmates break out of jail and then try to sneak back in. Gow's best guess about the motives of the two men, who briefly went on the lam late Tuesday, is that they wanted to buy some drugs, have a good time, and get back to the jail before anyone noticed. The plan fell apart when they were spotted climbing on an air conditioning unit and trying to re-enter the jail through the same hole they had made 2 hours earlier in the attic wall.
Well done.
Gow told KOAM-TV that authorities believe the men stole a pickup truck during the escape and then set it on fire upon their return to create a diversion. On Wednesday, both were in isolation and facing escape charges that carry a five-year sentence.
Oh, where was this at?
Missouri.
The awesome thing about that is, I mean, what elevates it is that there is, in fact, no evidence a diversion was necessary. A diversion, by definition, is a thing that gets attention from someone who you don't want paying attention. Like, that's the whole point of it. There is nothing in the story that indicates in any way that the man was aware that they had ever left the jail.
Right.
And so they just set a huge bonfire, like a signal flare, basically, but, like, vehicular, outside.
Right.
Thus drawing the attention. Here's the thing about the criminals, too, is it's like they managed to, is usually where they dug a hole or something?
Yeah, they dug a hole in the wall.
Which is kind of impressive, actually, because you think that jails would be made, like,
stronger?
Wouldn't you think that you couldn't do that? It's 2010.
You'd think.
I wouldn't think that you would be able to just tunnel out of a prison. It seems like that's...
And then they just went on a little field trip to go get some drugs.
Wow.
And then come back to jail.
Goddamn, people are dumb. People are just unbelievably stupid.
So that would make these gentlemen... our stupid criminals of the week.
Stupid criminal of the week, brought to you by mugshotlist.com, one of our very proud business partners here, the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We're here with Sarah X. Dillon and Greg Nibbler of FunEmploymentRadio.com today, taping their 200th episode.
200 episodes!
I should have prepared like a harp noise or something, or a sort of like, do you remember that time that we all got fired?
And oh, then God.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate that. Thanks so much.
That called for Vuvuzela.
That really is the best purchase I've ever
Thank
made.
Thank you.
Is that the first time you've ever used the Vuvuzela, which is...
No,
there?
I used it once before when we were doing something. And
this conversation sounds really dirty.
You were unhappy about it.
I was going to say, is that the first time you've ever blown that thing? And then I blah, blah, blah.
Have you used the Vuvuzela?
It's the first
before,
time I've ever blown a horn that large, Rick Emerson.
Thank you. So I have... We'll just use that as the... remember that one time we all got fired? And then you guys, like, immediately being way more productive than I am. I just went home and I just did nothing. I did, like, dick. Zero. Nada. Bupkis for, like, months on end. And it was...
Oh, that's not true. You were always hard at work at your Outlook Portland stuff.
Like, yeah, my once-per-week job where I tape a 22-minute television program.
It's something.
And where everybody else does all the work and I just sit there and, like, say, so, tell me about you. And then, you know, and then I just stare at the whatever. But you guys immediately... here's how I remember this. And tell me if I'm like blowing some bit you guys are going to do later on where you sort of recap the whole
thing.
Is that we all got fired, and then I don't know, we were
on
meeting
a Friday, on Friday, October 25th.
Was it Friday?
It was Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, because they made us come back?
Yeah, because we were all set for the weekend.
Because we had waited for an hour and a half in the morning when everyone was ignoring us.
That's right.
And we sat there and nobody came to talk to us, and so we're like, okay, I guess we're getting fired on Monday.
Well, and we were gone for like 5 or 6 hours before they even called.
They called us at 4 p.m.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay, so because we had been getting, because we had the vibe in the air that we were all going to get fired, and so my whole thing was every day when we get off the air, I'm like, all right, we're going to walk down the hall, and if they're going to do it, they'll be waiting in the office for us.
And so we all collectively walked together. Remember, we all waited in that side room.
And every day the office was empty. You know, if there was nobody there, we're like, okay, we get to do it another day. And that Friday, we were just absolutely convinced. Have I ever told you? I don't think I've ever revealed this, actually. I was so, maybe I have, maybe I told you guys off the air. I was so convinced, accurately as it turns out, that we were going to get fired on October 23rd of 2010. I was so convinced that I don't know if I told you this or not, that I emailed Peter Carlin and I said, hey, I think we're all getting fired tomorrow. Do you want to come and sit in the studio during our last show? And then be there when management fires us.
That's genius.
And I emailed him about that, and he said, of course, Peter. He's like, of course. I can't believe I didn't tell you. So I emailed, but I had told him, I'm like, no fooling. Like, I think tomorrow's it. And I'm like,
yeah, because we all thought it was going to be that Wednesday. Yeah, because the 23rd was a Wednesday. We all thought it was going to be that day.
And it's like, my whole thing was, and I just decided at that point just to make it like, you know, what the hell do I care? Just make it as uncomfortable as possible. And so I told him, I'm like, do you want to just come sit in the room when they fire us? And like, you know, and he's like, what if they ask me to leave? I'm like, you're the press. You can stay. So I was just going to have Peter Carlin sit there and just take notes as they fired us and make them do it with a reporter in the room.
Wow.
And have him document the whole last show minute by minute for the Oregonian, like the anatomy of a final show.
So they could actually see what it is like being in radio.
Because radio listeners, all they know is they turn on and it's like gone and it's some other guy. You know, and anyway, and so, and we email back and forth and he's like, well, let me know. And then I don't know why, but for whatever insane reason in my head on Thursday night, I somehow, and I must have had some reason for this, but on Thursday night, I somehow got into my head, maybe I read an email or maybe there was some anecdote or whatever, and and I started thinking that, well, okay, I guess it's going to be next week. I got the feeling somehow that it was that I'd gotten my vibes wrong and it was going to be the next week. So I told him, well, I'll get in touch with you like Monday and we'll figure it out. And then, of course, he emails me. And he's like, oh, my God, I should have been there. S is going down, isn't it? He was texting me.
Oh,
he's like, is the S going down? Tell me. And I was like, yes, yes, it is.
Well, weren't we scheduled for an event the next week?
We had done an event like, the night before. Remember?
Yeah,
we were
the Halloween.
No, we were at the picking out all the real world contestants at that bowling alley.
Well, no, that wasn't the day before.
No, the day before we did the walkthrough at Fright Town.
Yeah.
Because your friend.
Yeah, Dave Helfried.
Who is Baron Von Gulu.
Yeah.
He gave us the walkthrough the day before.
And remember, they were going to have me put on, like, there's like, oh, we're going to put you in full zombie makeup. And
yeah.
I'm like, crap, if they're firing me, I don't think so.
Yeah, like, no, no, thank you.
I mean, it sounded cool, but I'm just like, you know, I don't think it really.
Aren't you glad you didn't do anything, horrible right beforehand for, like, can I just tell you that here's radio for you? A company. I'll just screw it.
Someone in the text box says that you had a big interview scheduled for the next week as well. But
did we?
Yes.
Who was it?
Well, there was no interview.
Because we got Kevin Smith, we got Alice Cooper, we got those done.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
I think that was when they fired us from somewhere else.
Yeah.
He's confusing two firings there.
I think that was when we were fired from 910.
Yeah. Can I just tell you this? I know we're all over the place today, but it's Friday. F it. You don't have anywhere to be, do you?
Me? No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll get out of here.
This is our day.
We'll get out of here for you so you guys get the show.
I mean, honestly, like, all I'm planning on doing is hanging out in the studio today.
Excellent. Yeah.
Can I just tell you, just for this is totally bizarre that you mentioned when we got fired by Intercom. Somebody sent me this morning. Let's see if I moved it to my other inbox or if I actually got it.
It's amazing how many people that we worked with still actually work there.
Yeah.
It's weird. Like, whenever I turn on the radio or, like, I'm, like, seeing things from people, I'm just like, wow, you guys have been there for a really long time. Whereas we've worked for, like, three different companies.
You're still employed.
You have one of those job things.
Look at you.
That's all right. Crazy.
I will post this later on my on Facebook. A guy sent this to me, no lie, a guy sent this to me this morning for no reason. I mean, just, like, coincidentally with this whole conversation about being fired by Max 910, the subject line is, seriously? And then he says, I saw this yesterday and I had to send it to you. It is a picture. He took a picture of a guy on the street, just some guy he saw downtown. It is a guy, I swear to God, wearing a Max 910 shirt. And he says, I can't imagine why this dude would be wearing a Max 910 shirt, you know, in September of 2010. Maybe he was a grubby street teamer back in the day. Anyway, thought you might enjoy a laugh that a person actually has a Max 910 shirt touching their body.
Now, didn't somebody had, like, boxes of them in their basement?
Richie, I think Bristol. Richie has boxes of everything in
Richie
his basement.
Bristol.
Probably bodies.
And then he pulled the incredibly jackass Richie move of giving out Max 910 stuff to listeners at, like, one of our events when we had moved to CBS.
I remember that. He had all of the tumblers and everything, and they had the mud flap girl on them.
You want something from an Intercom radio station?
Yeah.
But anyway, so he just... So it's from this guy, Tony, and he said, so I snapped a shot of this picture from the back, and then he adds the caption... This shirt sucks. Put it on. So there you go. So look at that. There's a picture of a guy downtown in a Max 910 shirt. How weird is that?
That's unnerving.
It makes no sense at all. I have no idea why a guy would be wearing that.
I still have one of my Max 910 shirts. Yeah, it was like a classy, like embroidered one. And
I was first introduced to your show while you were there.
I'm sorry.
And I remember my husband had been a listener for a very long time. And he's like, all right, Rick Emerson this, Rick Emerson that, Sarah Dillon, blah, 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 Tim Riley, blah. And I'm like, shut up. Shut up about your imaginary radio friends. He's like, you know, if you listen to the show, you'd really like it. So I try listening. And it's like, and honest to God, I start listening. It's the station for men.
Oh,
and I was like,
do you remember?
Really, dude? You seriously listen to this? He's like, no, really. It used to be good. Part of it's the station they're at. That,
yeah.
No.
It's you know, they're really wonderful people. I mean, imaginary radio friends.
Yeah, no, there was a, I don't know if you wanted to say it or not.
Oh, no, I just remember there was a maybe you were fortunate enough to hear the pubic hair liner that they actually had on the station as a legitimate liner. And what exactly did it say?
It was like, so that one of the deals on Max 910.
Oh, God, it was so embarrassing. And I was like the only girl that worked on there. I'm like, seriously? This is like what my job is.
They had this whole notion, which was not in and of itself terrible, that the station voice would be this sort of fictitious guy named Max, which is not like a crazy idea, I guess. And that he would be sort of, you know, not just the voice of the station, but he would also supposedly be like a real guy.
You remember our clip art guy with the sunglasses?
Yeah, okay. Totally. Yeah, he'd be the.
He's like Leisure Suit Larry.
I was going to say
he
like
listens to the radio.
Yes, exactly. I was going to say like Poochie from The Simpsons. you know, and actually later on at CBS we actually did have a voice guy named Max who was sort of, you know, whatever. But so, you know, I can get with that idea. But he just made Max this like cretin. The management made Max just this leering, like horrible, like disease infested, like sex bot guy, and he was just terrible. But he was like this, but you look, and it's not like I'm a prude or anything. I mean, you all have heard the show. So it's, you know, I have no problem with the ladies in any sense. But the guy was just like a dick. He was just like a sleazy guy who borrows money and gives you crabs. Like, that was the kind of guy. so the station liners would all be like addressed at men, but all kind of passively and like really like hatefully, like in a way that only a guy who is badly divorced and never gets laid can be hateful toward women. Mm-hmm. The kind of guy who joins like a men's rights organization and talks about how, you know, if I was a chick, you know, or an African American, everything would be fine. And I'd probably be getting a big check every month, like for no reason. Like, in other words, like a guy who is like your a-hole stepfather named Jerry. That's exactly who the Max guy sounded like. Like every narrow-minded, like bigoted dick you have ever known. But, you know, hip. And so he voiced all of these liners. And one of them was like, don't try to impress me by pretending you know about sports, little lady. If you want to impress me, I swear to God.
Oh, God.
If you want to impress me, shave the team logo into your pubes. Max 910.
Oh, wow. Lord.
I swear to God, that's what
I know. I can vouch for it. I was in there. I'm like, are you kidding me?
So that's the persona.
Wow.
That's what I'm saying.
God.
And, like, everybody has known a guy that maybe didn't say that at the office, but you knew he probably said that stuff, like, later at home when he was, like, drinking with his boys.
Oh, come on. We worked with a lot of guys over there that
yes,
totally
we
looked
did.
Like they would like that.
Yes, we did. That's it. And so, yeah, everybody has worked with, like, that jackass,
mm-hmm.
You know, and who just says horrible things on a constant basis. And they decided that was the persona of the station, which they just sort of, like, foisted. So we were just sort of stuck underneath that umbrella. So God only knows, I mean, what anybody who listened to that station and didn't know who we were would have thought. I mean, it's, you know, Jesus. So
you did seem to have an unusually large number, and this is for Portland, of ads for strip clubs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, because who else would want to advertise? And look, it's not like I have any problem with strip clubs or taking their money or them being in business. It's like, it's just that no one else wanted to be associated with the station.
No, but I mean, but also, though, you're listening to something, you're enjoying a program with two M's and an E of some sort. And then, yeah, and then that Waka Chicka Waka Chicka music comes in. And the girl going, yeah. Hi, are you lonely and sad and you've got too much money in your pocket? Come down to Hoodly Jiggly Puffs.
Let me dance for you.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, oh, God, I hate
thank you.
Everyone. I hate humanity.
What? And there was it Jiggles? That
it was
happened?
Jiggles.
I was going to say Jiggles.
No, it was like the beep, 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 beep. Hello? It's Jiggles. Come on down for our juice bar and sexy ladies. Let me dance for you.
And then she did say, let me dance for you.
Oh, God.
And you know something? I live at just off of the Jiggles off ramp is my off ramp where I live.
Have you been there?
And every time I say, no, I've never been there. But I used to, when I met Patrick, actually, I was working at Starbucks. And I worked at the Starbucks in Tualatin. And I used to get the Jiggles dancers in there before their shifts coming in for their macchiatos. So I actually got to chat with a number of the strippers and mostly enjoy the way my 17-year-old male coworker would enjoy talking to the strippers before their shift.
Were they attractive?
They were attractive.
Because that's like a juice bomb.
They were relatively ordinary-looking women, actually.
So they weren't like
a... You've been to Jiggles?
I have. I made the requisite trip when I turned 18 to Jiggles. And, yeah, I mean, they were attractive girls. But then again, I didn't have any point of reference for a strip club either. So I'm just like, they're naked. That's fine. That's all I cared about.
Believe me, I also lived in North Portland near the...
The Dance and Bear.
I love that place.
So, and if you actually look on the website, they have pictures of the girls for the Dance and Bear. And you just kind of go, You know, and wow, and those are their glamour shots. Yeah. And they all look like mug shots, I swear to God.
One time I was at the Dancing Bear and I saw some dude actually like with a handful of quarters, like... throwing the quarters at the strippers.
Wow.
He was just like, beep, and like flicking this like pro girl's like working the pole, and he's just like, here you go, sweetie, and just like flipping quarters. And then the saddest thing was that she picked them all up at the end.
Oh, wow.
That's sad.
With her hands, I hope.
I think that was actually the first. I don't want to say, God only knows how many radio station events we had to do at strip clubs over the years. And it's again, not like I'm passing judgment. It's just not a place that I'm not a strip club guy. It's just not a thing that has any appeal for me. And we've talked about that it's like, you know, I just don't see the point. But we would have to go there for these radio station things. But when I was 19, I guess, because it was when I was here. It was when I was here to see like the Metallica Guns N' Roses show. No, it was when I was here to see Metallica at Portland Fairgrounds, which would have been the same year. So I would have been like 19 anyway. But I was staying with my sister who lived in St. John's, and it was like, you know, and she'd gone to bed or something, and I'm 19, and you know, like single guy in the city. What am I in the big? You know, what am I gonna do? And I thumb through like a retard. I'm thumbing through the yellow pages looking for thrills, and I went to Dance and Bear, and all I remember was the saddest thing. I mean, maybe not nearly as sad as the quarter thing, but it was like a girl dancing to that Hurt song by Nine Inch Nails.
Oh.
You're like, what did your dad do to you that you're stripping to Hurt? And I just laughed. I was like, I can't even be. I couldn't make it through one song. I just took off.
I know I told you this. The sign for the Dance and Bear, of course, it has a picture of a bear and then an X through it and then a picture of a naked lady. So you knew they'd be dancing. Bear, B-A-R-E, not the other guy. And I was driving by there with a friend of mine, and he, who is an odd person anyway, and he's looking at the sign. He goes, wouldn't it be cool if, like, all the strippers just came out and danced in a bear suit? And
like
I said, so what, like they're wearing a bear suit, and they strip off the bear suit, and there's a naked girl underneath? And he goes, no. Just that there's a naked girl inside the bear suit, but they never take it off.
That's odd. Was he a furry?
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like a furry type of thing.
No, he's just an odd person. And then he just sat there and he just giggled for about 10 minutes thinking about it.
I know, that's weird. Under there
is what that is.
The worst strip club, we've talked about it before on the show, the worst strip club I ever saw was, it wasn't Hawthorne, when it used to be Dino's. There was a mentally retarded stripper.
Oh. Wait, was it Dino's or the Hawthorne? Is it the Hawthorne
Strip
now?
It's the Hawthorne Strip.
But it was Dino's.
It used to be Viper Room.
I would pay money to see
that. No, Viper Room was down the street.
Now, is that a lesbian strip club? That's what I always heard, that it was had a large, the clientele was a lot of, like, really butch women.
But this one, it was definitely, it's upgraded a little since it became Hawthorne Strip. But I mean, like, there's nothing.
I'm not especially interested in going to a strip club, but if you promised me, say, like, retarded people or midgets, I would be there.
I mean,
I would totally go.
How did you know?
It just was.
I don't.
You could tell.
No, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, like,
It was the kind that's
with
on the
foldy,
face
with the foldy eyes. You know what I'm talking about, right?
It's like Corky's girlfriend dancing.
Yeah,
with the Amanda. Foldy eyes.
Look, everybody knows. I'm not trying to be cruel. Everyone knows what you're talking about. I mean, language is about conveying a point in the shortest possible time, Dawn. And foldy eyes.
Exactly.
She was just so damn happy doing it, though. Man.
Well, I think happiness is a little bit.
She made a lot of money. Like, everyone's
good,
just like,
good for her, I guess.
I feel like exactly. I shouldn't be looking at this. Here's a 20.
Everyone's going, good for you.
Well, I mean,
here's some money.
I mean, you know, hey, I mean, everybody's got to pay the rent. And, you know that there must be, I mean, it's like, what is that 4chan thing? Where, you know, like, rule 34 is like, if it exists, there's porn for it. And you know that there must be a fetish somewhere for, you know, God. There must be some. And the thing is, even if the fetish is a tiny number of guys, you've got 100% of them and their money. So, I mean, if you can isolate a fetish, you're in the chips, because even if there's, in fact, if there are almost no guys into it, you're probably going to make more money because they will pay for anything that caters to their weird freaking fetish.
I'm just thinking about this girl going home in the evening and she's all happy and she's like, I made $300. Apples! That'd just be awesome.
Terrible person. Don Taylor, I'm ashamed and sickened. I will not be party to this alleged humor that you were trafficking in.
Oh, says the guy who was just talking about a retard fetish.
That was just in a theoretical sense, only in the sense that it's a big world and there's probably a combination of every two things you
can
have.
It sounds like you're trying to encourage someone to start like a retarded person porn site.
Well, you get
100% of the profit.
Are you the 0.5% that would have?
You get Sarah and Greg in here,
no.
And you give me a beer and everything just like, just zooms downhill, doesn't it?
Well, that's a good way to segue into Fun Employment Radio's 200th episode, which is coming up this afternoon. So we're live now. So if it's 3 o'clock now, about what time do you estimate? When will this be up tonight?
Six.
All right.
Yeah.
Anything? You don't have to give it away, but anything special planned for today, or is it just a day of remembering?
Well, yesterday was a huge day for us because we had
Greg Proops.
Only Greg Proops from Whose Line Is It Anyway in studio. So
how was he? I didn't get a chance. I heard something through the door, and then I had to leave.
He smells very good.
He was a very attractive man.
He's taller than I expected, very well groomed, and he smelled really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we talked to him for like an hour and a half almost.
Yeah, he was supposed to be on for 15 minutes, and then we all just ended up talking, and pretty soon his handler's kind of like, you got to get to the club.
Yeah.
I know, and then
yeah.
we realized that his show started in 2 hours. We're like, oh, God, okay, you've got to go.
Well, I was here for, I don't know, 20 or 25 minutes, and it sounded like, even just through the door, I could hear like the muffled sounds of a good time being had by
You would have loved Tim Rick, because he was telling us all kinds of Jerry Lewis stories.
Really?
Uh-huh. Yep. Like all his experiences.
That's the way to my heart.
Oh, I know, Jerry Lewis and porn.
No, that's...
Yes, Jerry Lewis, porn, and...
Wait, to whom are you speaking to and whom are you speaking about there when you said Jerry Lewis and porn?
He was talking about how Jerry Lewis was doing this telethon recently, and he was just kind of delirious, and he was like, and man, I just watched some really good porn.
Wow, really?
Yeah. And then there was just like silence. He's like, and by porn, I mean this new thing that is, this new show that I've been watching. And like,
yeah, or like try to spin it into a sponsor or somehow.
My timing is totally screwing me here. I'm trying to load up the appropriate soundboard, and it's just not coming together
fast
enough.
Damn.
My Jerry Lewis sound from earlier this week, which I do believe was from the Labor Day telethon.
It was indeed. And you were going to torture me with that every day, and thankfully you forgot.
What else did he
do? Oh, I'm still going to find a reason to do it. So this is a... I've managed to screw myself there twice. All right. So this is from the Labor Day telethon. I hadn't told Dom what these cuts were going to be. She just knew that we had Labor Day sound bites from the, you know. And
walk on with hope in your heart, and you'll never, never walk alone. You will never walk.
I picture those strippers dancing to this song.
I am so
the retarded stripper.
Overcome yeah. by what we have done. Because I guess in the back of my mind and my heart, if we struck out, I wouldn't know how to look at my kids. What did I do wrong?
Walk on, walk on. With hope in your heart.
Hi, Don.
Hi.
You thought I'd forgotten about this.
I did. I'd hoped.
Hey, just speaking of this, and as it relates to nothing else in particular, did you guys hear Shatner talking about Twitter?
No.
Oh, you know, Shatner's on Twitter now.
I was just trying to figure out Twitter in the kitchen. I still have no idea how it works.
Oh, no, it's a thing that's beyond, it's beyond, I think, any human mind, because it's like,
I use the Twitter.
Well, okay, show me how to use the Twitter?
Sure.
Okay.
after you show how to use the Vuvuzela, it's a thing where, like, I know how to send, like, a message. Like, I can say, I didn't because I'm retarded and I forgot. But I can say, like, Sarah and Greg going to be on soon. Listen now. But, you know, but there's that whole, like...
you say that, but it took you, like, 45 minutes to get through to it on your phone the day the...
You see that phone still around here anywhere? That phone paid the price, Don. The ultimate price.
Wow, you showed that.
Yeah, it was the BlackBerry's fault.
But it's that. But it's that thing where, like, on the sidebar, it shows like all of the different things you can do with Twitter, like all of the like lists and groups and timeline. And that's where I'm just like, "F it."
I don't understand.
No,
that at all.
I have no idea what's going on.
Like direct messages and like, yeah, you follow people. Like, I don't get it.
I mean, I just learned the bare minimum to use it to make people pay attention to me, and that's it.
Start playing that Walton music right now.
I'm just saying, well, I'll do the Shatner thing. So this is he just got a Twitter account and a Facebook account because he was it did that thing of like one recommendation, William Shatner ought to be your friend. And that's because Thomas Gill is my friend, by the way. It told me that. So this is Shatner talking about being on Twitter now, though.
I don't Twitter. I can't even remember my password name. So I have problems with electronics. And so what I've done is I've hired a young man out of college whose very fingers are the extension of computer keys. And
I'm drunk.
He twitters, he does the mechanics. But I very carefully modulate what I say and have used Twitter to publicize stuff, to have conversations, instigate competition. It's been a...
He's just finding words in his mental dictionary.
It's like Mad Libs in his brain.
Seriously.
Immediate language of being
polish
short-term
the telescope.
And pithy. And I have had a growing and glowing experience with Twitter.
Walk on, walk on.
Well, not even so. Yeah, so the Greg Proops thing sounded like it went really, really well. I mean, it sounded like he was having a great time.
It was amazing. It was like a dream come true. I mean, I watched Whose Line Is It Anyway? You know, ever since I was a little kid, and like he was.
Kelsey was here and nervous.
Kelsey was freaking. Yeah, we put her in charge of the video camera, which was a mistake.
Yeah, that didn't work out so good.
She's all like so excited and nervous that it's all jittery and we can't use any of the material.
She came into the kitchen later. She's like, "I only got 5 minutes of video," and then she just like sat there and just did nothing. So, just to bring all this back around before we wrap it up and get out of here. We all got fired on October 23rd or whatever, that Friday. I shouldn't say this. There's one more thing I shouldn't say.
Oh, you totally say it.
That I will, though. Okay. That's always that. I told Courtney Hameister that when she was starting to do some, you know, podcast stuff. I'm like, get used to, like, thinking you shouldn't say something, but then 5 seconds later, like, saying the thing.
That is exactly what you should say.
Do that after you've told all of your loved ones not to listen, like, ever.
Yes.
Is that a lesson that are some of us still learning?
Yeah,
that lesson?
Well, our intern is actually in the room right now, Kenny B. And we've had great fun in...
Have you told... do you have a significant other? Mm-hmm. Have you told him / her / whoever not to listen?
She just stopped on her own. I didn't know.
Right. Yeah, because we started having fun at her expense, and then I'm just like, Kenny, if you love her, tell her to never listen to the podcast ever again.
You don't say, Kenny, you know, you can always just not talk about these things. No, you don't say that. Yeah. You just like, just don't let her listen.
No.
Because otherwise, you know.
Well, the worst mistake she ever made was also, like, letting both Greg and I be her Facebook friends.
Yes.
Because now all like the silly things that they write back and forth, like, I love you, baby. I love you more, baby. I'm so lucky.
Wait a minute. Was she the one?
She's a super hot nerd girl.
Was she the one who wrote that thing?
Yes.
I don't know if I should say
it. Yeah, I think
loud.
It was if
everyone had sex.
No,
or
if
no,
everyone.
If my body. How did she say it?
My recollection of, because I heard you guys. Can I say
if
this?
My
out
body.
Loud?
If everyone was treated like my body was, there would be no wars in the world.
That's right. That's and it's like, which is all well and good, and well done. But you know.
And then we were trying to casually figure it out. We're like, what does she mean? And then like a few comments down, she's like, you know, I'm talking about a fantastic sex, right?
Wow.
I'm like, Kenny B.
Well, Jesus.
So Kenny basically makes sure that she's economically stable.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that she has full voting rights.
Yes.
And therefore, she is satisfied and does
exactly.
not want
that's,
to go to war.
That's what she's saying.
I'm sure.
I will say this one final thing before we end, which is that we were talking about how we were fired on a Friday, and they actually made the mistake, for whatever reason, except I now know the reason. Because, you know, there's that whole thing where they let us go home. They let us go home on Friday. Like, not let us go fire, but they let us leave for the weekend. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I guess we're working Monday.
I was just wandering around Hawthorne. Huzzah! La, 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 la.
And then I went home and took a nap, and I woke up, and it was like, you have 75 missed calls. And it was like all the new management and the everybody and, like, you know, Ditch, and you know, all those guys. She's like saying, like, you gotta get to work, man. It's Ditch. Oh, yeah.
Who we had never met. Yeah.
I've been ignoring you for the past month, but now all of a sudden I really need to talk to you.
Yeah.
And so I knew the jig was up, and I think I talked to you, and I was like, I don't know. And I actually said, again, with the uncomfortable, I was like, let's make him wait, and then let's show up Monday like we're going to do the show.
I know. You totally did. You almost had me convinced to do that, too. Like, no, let's just get it
and
over
with. And that was your thing, is you're like, actually, here, Sarah goes, if I'm going to start drinking, I'm going to do it like now, so can we get this done? And I was like, all right.
Yeah, when Scott Mahalik called, and he's just like, hi, Sarah, my name's Scott. We've never really met before, but I'd love it if you'd come back into this office. I'm like, honey, I know what's going on. Yeah. He's like, I just can't seem to get a hold of anybody else. Could you call them for me?
Darndest thing. Well, I found out why. I found out why that was. So you know that you know the weird countdown mothership thing they were playing?
Yeah.
Which is like, it would be like a movie quote, and then it would say like 3 hours, 5 days, 2 minutes and 12 seconds, whatever, you're being assimilated. Yeah. And then it counted down to the launch of the new The Kid Chris Show or whatever Monday. Believe it or not, their plan, inexplicably, I mean, because either, I want to be really clear. It's not like I'm taking it personally. I'm really not. It just doesn't make any sense to me, because whatever else you want to say about those guys, about Alpha, they have between them, you know, like 50 years of experience in radio or something. So it's not like they just got into the business or something. Their plan, I swear to you, was apparently to let that tease mothership thing run all weekend, counting down to the big station change before they fired us, which they were going to do Monday. Which means, of course, that we would have like found out about it like Saturday morning or, you know, Friday night. So we actually, if all had gone according to plan, would have had all weekend to be listening to that going, well, that sounds like they're going to fire us. I wonder what's that about? And then they were going to meet us actually on Monday morning.
Really?
They were going to fire us at 3 o'clock in the morning?
They were going to make us listen to that all weekend and then come in for work.
I swear to
that
God.
That is messed up.
I swear to God. That is the...
That doesn't make me very happy.
No, I'm glad I'm fighting that out
I'm
now.
Glad that I didn't know.
And not... Yeah, back then.
And what bothers me is that it's been almost a year and that still bothers me.
I swear to God, that's the truth. And wow. then cooler heads prevailed. And they were told that was perhaps the stupidest idea ever created by human minds.
We actually tried to plan these firings so that they don't go out to their car and get a pistol and come back and shoot us.
So
maybe this isn't a good idea.
And then, they were told, I think, that no, that's a bad idea. You've chosen the wrong option.
That's
go with
just
A.
Some douche who didn't want to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning on Monday.
Maybe they just won't come in then. I mean... So when I heard that, anyway, so that was Friday, and then you guys, like, I don't know, less than a week later, you guys did the first Fun Employment, what became Fun Employment.
Yeah, we were laid off on the 25th, and then we had our first show on the 5th of November.
Okay. Yeah, but we had started recording even.
So it was the 25th. I don't know why it's important that I get that date straight in my head. I don't remember any of the other dates.
It sticks in my head, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
October
the 25th,
25th.
Friday, yeah. And then, it was the next Monday?
No, that we started recording. Yeah. We started recording, I think, middle of that next week.
Wednesday,
yeah, like
I think.
Wednesday. But we didn't launch anything until the 5th of November.
Yeah, because all of us were all talking on the phone. You
the
know,
5th
like,
of November. Hey,
yes.
That's
look
how
at
we
you.
Started it.
Remember?
We started
wow.
it with
well
the
done.
V for Vendetta quote.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on having today your
Thank
200th
you.
Episode.
Thanks.
So,
and we were just so excited to be able to, like, you know, we're all in our big podcasting world now, and we get to see you guys every day.
Yeah.
This is fun.
You know, there's that stupid thing about when life closes one door, it opens another, and whatever, and you'll go on to bigger, better things, and it's not like I'm going to say that, like, you know, that I didn't, you know, we didn't enjoy, you know, working there, or certain, you know, all the areas of the show, even the KUFO show, which had issues, you know, it's like there was some, you know, I think, you know, we did some great stuff, and it was, you know, there was moments that were really funny, and we made people laugh and dance and sing.
The mystery guest thing was the best thing ever.
Oh, that was fun.
That's when Greg and I started plotting, like, you know, because that was fun to, like, get together and be like, who could we get on with Rick?
I swear to God, the other day, I answered a trivia question about the Wizards of Waverly Place, and it was totally because you had me talk to that kid.
The one I regret that we didn't get was Tori Spelling and Dean McDermott or whatever. At the same time. It would have been a double interview.
You tried really hard for that.
I really wanted that to happen.
And we've all, you know, we've all got people we know is still worth it, their friends and whatever. But that being said, I really am glad that we all kind of ended up over here. You guys aren't watching Mad Men right now, are you?
No, but I'm going to start watching.
Because, you know, I don't want to spoil it then, but are you current with Mad Men?
No, it's one I haven't started yet.
Well,
I don't care.
I guess it's something of a spoiler, but, you know, at the end of the third season of Mad Men, They sense that something sinister is afoot with the new owners of their ad agency. Stop me if this sounds familiar. That a concern from out of town has purchased the ad agency, has sworn there will be no changes, and then immediately it becomes clear they're about to fire everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the dead of night, they return to the office. Again, stop me if this sounds familiar. I'm looking in your direction, Court. If people start going to the office in the middle of the night and spiriting their belongings home because they fear the heavy hammer of unemployment coming down, and then they break off and they start their own smaller agency, taking a core of employees with them and braving a brand new world together.
And of course, the employees left behind come into the office on Monday morning and are like, "Where's the furniture?
Yeah, where's all our client files?" Yeah. So
I remember the weeks like leading up, a couple weeks before we were all fired. Remember, all of us would take one thing home.
Totally.
Every day we'd be like, "All right, we're starting to like slowly bring all of our possessions home."
Oh yeah, I'd stuff my backpack.
Which all of your stuff is still sitting in a box in my kitchen.
Yeah, there's a lot of it over there.
My stuff is all except for the stuff I needed to start this show here. It's all still in the garage. I haven't even touched it.
I haven't touched mine either. Remember, I grabbed it. I put it on that huge like energy drink container.
Like collapsible
the red
cooler.
Thing.
The big thing. Yep, the collapsible cooler. And I just threw all my crap in there. And I'm just like, Greg, just put your stuff in there too, because we just kind of wanted to get out. And it's just been sitting in the corner of my kitchen for the past 11 months.
Someone on the text box does say, your listeners love you all, Rick, Dawn, Sarah, and Nibman.
Thank you.
That's nice.
Thank you.
All right. Well, congratulations, you guys. And it's I'm glad we're all here as one big happy family.
Are you guys going to be gracing us with your presence on our show today?
Sure.
Why not?
I'm going to need another beer.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, you get some beer, I'll get some caffeine, and we will appear on Fun Employment Radio, which you guys are going to be taping here just a few. And it'll be up this evening, so they'll be listening for that. All right, are we done? Is there anything? We've got everything done? We've checked off? We got all our commitments taken care of?
Yeah, we've got a couple of things left over, but there always are.
And we'll do it. We'll do that on Monday. We want to thank our special guests, Greg Nibbler and Sarah X. Dillon of Fun Employment Radio, funemploymentradio.com. Also, Michael Schaub of bookslut.com, and Mr. Kenny Johnson, late of The Shield, now of Sons of Anarchy. And all that stuff's going to be posted at rickemerson.com later on today. Don't forget, after a brief musical interlude, today's encore of Legion of News will begin, followed by the encore of this program, and then later tonight, check out Fun Employment Radio at funemploymentradio.com and so forth. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk is Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Ackler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. It is Friday, September 10th, 2010, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth. My name is Rick Emerson. Thanks for listening. See y'all later and on Fun Employment Radio tonight. Bye now.
Walk on, walk on, with hope in your heart, and you'll never, never walk alone.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks.